Harper Audio presents Heartbreak Hotel by Ann Rivers Siddons, performed by Jane Alexander. Before Maggie Deloche went back for her senior year at college, there had been a benevolent Order of Elks parade, a water ballet at the municipal swimming pool in which she had starred with a flimsy backstroke and a water lily face, a rhinestone tiara loaned from a gift and jewelry chain store in Atlanta, a speech by the governor, and a tattered monkey on the end of a leash held by a J.C. It had been the centennial celebration of her town, a small, heat-stunned town named Lytton, strung out on both sides of the Atlanta and West Point Railroad south of Atlanta. And Maggie had been the queen, largely because she had a yard of tan, spectacular legs, slanted odd brown eyes, an apple-green organdy hoop-skirted dress with a hat to match, an attorney father who knew the governor that would have gotten her, at that time, into any graduate school in the South. Her grades and antecedents, both a product of no effort whatsoever on her part, had gotten her as far as she had gone at her undergraduate school, for it took less to get further in the South in the middle 50s. Maggie, tiara'd and slow-eyed and itching for whatever, sweated the governor's paths and the monkey's probings equally and docilely. They were both part of the rules. If she had thought about it consciously, Maggie would have liked the monkey a bit better than the governor. The monkey had one choice, to bite the J.C. or the governor or whoever annoyed him, or not to bite. It was inconceivable that Margaret Hamilton Deloche should bite the governor. Rather, she smiled. On the last night of the centennial celebration, Maggie was crowned with the loaned crown at a ceremony in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Lodge, and given an armful of red roses by the mayor of Lytton, and danced the first dance with her father as if she were bowing to society. But she had, in fact, bowed to Lytton's small society 21 years earlier, when a tasteful card, inscribed with her name, date and time of birth, length, weight, and her parents' names, Frances Hamilton and Coma Hutchinson Deloche, went out in a January snowstorm to most of Lytton and a few people in Atlanta. There had never been another birth announcement after Maggie's to come from the tall old house with the stone gateposts on Coleman Street. It was as though Maggie was stamped sufficient at her birth, and any other child would have been extraneous and afterthought. It was a good night crowning a good week for Frances and Coma Deloche, and they have the centennial scrapbook still. Maggie has a small, star-shaped scar from a monkey bite. After that, 2 days later, she went back to school. She drove the two-tone green Plymouth coupe her parents had given her when she graduated from high school, and it was full of crinolines and starched cotton skirts and blouses, ironed to blooming, sheened perfection from a week earlier by loving Black Carrie, and hung from a broomstick sawed off and fitted over the back seat. It was the first quarter of her last year at school, and she was going to summer school because she had done so for the past 2 years. There was little waiting for her at her East Alabama University except graduation, but there was less in Lytton. When she drove into Randolph, Alabama, it was 2 p.m. Central Standard Time on Friday, June the 15th, 1956. The making of Maggie Deloche was a process as indigenous to her part of the South as the making of cotton textiles in the mills that crouched over the muddy, fast-moving rivers of the Georgia and Alabama Plateau Country. But it was a process far more narrowly applied. In the cities of the South, in Atlanta and Birmingham and Charlotte and Mobile and Charleston, there were perhaps 100 Maggies flowering in any given year, girls planted, tended, and grown like prize roses, to be cut and massed and shown at debutante balls and cotillions in their 18th year. Unlike roses, they did not die after the showing. Instead, they moved gently into colleges and universities and junior league chapters, and were then pressed between the leaves of substantial marriages to be dried and preserved. In the smaller towns, there were always perhaps 3 or 4 current Maggies, and in the smallest, like Lytton, there was only a Maggie. Nevertheless, the technique of creation varied only in small details and circumstances. It was a process of rules, subtle, shaded, iron bylaws that were tacitly drafted in burned and torn households, sometime during the Reconstruction by frail, reeling gentlewomen throughout the exploded South, laws for the shaping of new women who would be, forever after, impervious to casual, impersonal chaos. The formula lasted, with only those modifications that were a nod to the times, through a world war and a depression and another world war. Its end product, the young women of a certain caste of the South, were, on the main, as uniformly bright, hard, shining, and true as bullets from identical molds. There was no reason to think that the rules would fail to hold, certainly no omens of mechanical malfunction when the life of Maggie Deloche began. There was never any doubt in the minds of Francis and Coma Deloche that the love they lavished on Maggie was honest love, nor was there in Maggie's mind, and Maggie still does not doubt it. Fierce, fathomless love is seldom wise love, but as Maggie told her therapist only a year ago, it is infinitely better than no love or cool, constructed affection. Maggie was taken early and often to doctors, dentists, piano and art and dancing teachers, the better children's ready-to-wear departments, always in Atlanta. Sunday school and church services never began without Maggie Deloche, in that year's blue or burgundy velvet coat, leggings and bonnet to match. Piano and dancing recitals were never without her plodding, competent small fingers and feet and her grave face. Maggie was, for all her cadet training, a quiet child whose reticence looked sometimes like an oddly lovely sullenness, and sometimes was. Maggie had the only Shetland pony in Lytton, and the only professional permanent wave given to a child. She went, with only a few minor lapses, from Gerber babyhood into winsome toddlerhood into exemplary pre-puberty. She was a bright child and an increasingly and disturbingly pretty one. "Storm cutting up behind them eyes," Carrie would say, and a small surf of unease would wash over Frances. Maggie read early, and this made Frances inexplicably uneasy also. Comer was charmed and amused when his small daughter ignored the carefully chosen books from Lytton's branch of the Carnegie Library and buried herself in his leather-bound volumes of Shakespeare, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Walt Whitman. De Maupassant was regularly taken away from her.
"Comer, I don't mind her reading when she's resting or the weather's bad, but she's always got her nose in the book. She reads it under the covers with a flashlight. She told me the other night that Harry Hotspur plays in the sandbox with her, and she talks to him, and I've seen her out there right by herself, talking to nobody for hours. Comer, it's just not right for a child to lose touch with real things like that."
Frances Deloche talked mainly in italics. It was always one of her greatest charms for her husband, and it kept her a girl to him always. "Let her read," he said. "She's as smart as a whip, and it isn't trash she's reading, Franny." And so reading remained one of Maggie's small and constant rebellions. Maggie spelled impeccably and wrote small poems about her dogs and her pony on Blue Horse school tablets. She drew with an early and mechanical facility, though little imagination, an endless succession of rearing horses with flowing manes. And she had playmates, the handful of children her age who lived in Lytton proper. Most of Lytton's young lived on outlying farms and helped with the chores at an age when Maggie was still not allowed to cross the street, and Maggie knew little of their existence, except to see them in overalls and bare feet, spilling out of pickup trucks and going into Lytton's feed and hardware and grocery stores with their parents on Saturday afternoons. It was not that Frances and Coma Deloche considered them inferior to Maggie. Indeed, Frances was fond of saying that her own childhood on a farm had been healthful and happy in the extreme. It was only that they had so little in common with her. This was true. Maggie would have found little to say to those tough, laconic children in whose worlds a Shetland pony was a ridiculous toy of an animal that wasn't worth spit in front of a plow. Maggie much preferred the company of adults, and since she was a precocious and mannerly child, and charming to look at, the people who came to play bridge and have cake and coffee with Francis and Coma suffered her presence with grace and even interest. She was in the habit of curling up with her cheek pressed against the warm, round, wood-fretted vent hole of the big floor model Magnavox in the Deloche living room, so quiet, so still, that it was easy to lose her in the lamp-lit room. By the time she was 10, Frances had quite forgotten to admonish, "Little pitchers have big ears," and Maggie absorbed the talk of Lytton's select adulthood like a hardy, hidden flower in spring rain. High school was, for Maggie, a walk-through. Frances's rules, absorbed as by osmosis through Maggie's faultless olive skin, proved to be workable, and augmented by her flashing, if unoiled, intelligence, they obtained for her all that Frances and Coma could have asked. Lytton's high school was a consolidated county school, in a student body comprised largely of rangy, rough-knuckled teenagers ferried in every day by buses from the outlying farms and returned in time for a good 3 hours' chores. Maggie shone like a Staffordshire shepherdess. On the night of her graduation, Frances and Coma gave a party for Maggie's entire senior class in the vast backyard of the Coleman Street house. All her teachers were invited, too, and came. There was ginger ale and lime sherbet punch and sandwiches and Japanese lanterns in the old oaks. Maggie was radiant, animated, tense in yellow, too. Black Carrie, carrying out another tray, stopped to talk to the next-door maid who had been recruited for extra help.
"She looked like a princess, don't she?" said Carrie. "That child always has been too good to be true."
In a shadowy corner of the yard, the young English teacher from Ohio, whose first teaching job had been Maggie's senior English class, poured a tot of gin from a pint bottle in his pocket into his punch cup and regarded Maggie, who had won, under his tutelage, a national essay contest on traditional values in a changing world. No Lytton student had ever done such a thing. The young teacher's tenure was assured. "That," he said to the assistant football coach who was sharing the gin, "is the most anonymous girl I have ever seen." 3 weeks later, Frances drove Maggie in a snowstorm of new summer clothes to Randolph University. Coma followed in Maggie's new graduation Plymouth. Randolph had been Frances's and Coma's first choice. It had a good but not frightening academic standing, a good but not outre English department, Maggie's major, and strict rules governing its women students. After they had hung her curtains and made her bed and plugged in her record player and student lamp and hung her clothes in her closet and found a parking place close to the dormitory for Maggie's Plymouth, Frances and Coma kissed Maggie, and Frances wept, and they drove away. Maggie sat down on her bed. She lit a cigarette and looked out her window over the women's quadrangle and waited for her roommate and for other things. "Now," said pretty Maggie through smoke. "Now." Randolph, Alabama, in June 1956, looked much as it had for the past 30 years. It was a town born of its child 84 years earlier, and though both town and college had grown larger, it was as though they had both been magnified rather than matured. Randolph University took its name, sprang up, which in turn had been named for the one affluent planter in the county. It had flourished fitfully on its plain, steeped in undulating wet heat in summer and blasted with cheek-chapping winds howling an unbroken 100 miles from the west in winter since its inception. Such academic grace as Alabama had to offer was the province of the older state university to the west, in white, neoclassic Tuscaloosa, where the progeny of Alabama's cotton and peanut aristocracy had always been sent to be prepared to take up the guttering torch of agricultural patriarchy. Randolph was pragmatically and paternally designed some years later to accommodate the next echelon, the future engineers, veterinarians, high school teachers, and agricultural artisans of the new South. A handful of professors of some real academic note were lured to the campus to dispense such exotica as contemporary poetry, philosophy, ethics, dance, drama, fine and applied art, largely to a swelling stream of girls like Maggie, and a few young men thought to be fruity by the boys on Ag Hill. Randolph's business district consisted of four streets in a grid, four traffic lights, a railroad passenger depot for the Fay train that shambled from Montgomery to Atlanta, a Greyhound bus station cum post office, five service stations, and a Western Union office with a derelict franchise dance studio upstairs. On the fringes of downtown Randolph, boarding houses offered home-cooked meals to male students who scorned the dormitory dining halls and were not Greek-affiliated. Women students dined, perforce, at the women's dining hall in the women's quadrangle, or at their sorority houses. Farther out on the Montgomery and Opelika and Birmingham highways, there was a sprinkling of peeling wooden cubes where students could dance, drink beer, and play pinball machines, from which women students were barred and to which they went in droves. And to the southeast, on the Alabama side of the Chattahoochee River, across from Columbus, Georgia, lay Phoenix City, smeared in sooty citadel of strip shows, glass brick and neon bar and lounges, whorehouses, organized crime, and life. So Sodom and Gomorrah was Phoenix City that any woman student known to have visited there faced instant expulsion, and most of the popular girls had gone there with dates by the time they were juniors.
Maggie! Maggie!
An ecstatic fluting squeal from an open upstairs window of the Kappa house caught Maggie, laden chin-high with crinoline and trailing extension cords, halfway up the weed-choked flagstone walk. A white blonde head helmeted with pin curls followed the squeal out the window. Delia June Curry from Prattville.
God, I'm glad to see you. There's but nobody in this whole place. Look at your tan. Let me have some of that stuff. Oh, look, that's darling. It's new.
Later, after seven sweating trips up the curving staircase from the Kappa foyer, they sat on the bare mattress of Maggie's still unmade twin bed in her upstairs rear bedroom and lit cigarettes. Beaded Coca-Colas from the rusted machine in the basement laundry room were already tepid in the swaddling heat. It was very quiet and still and hot, and no time at all.
"What are you doing back so early?"
asked Delia through a double-nostriled plume of Kent smoke. She was startlingly Botticelli pretty, even in pin curls and baby doll pajamas and cuticura dots.
"Oh, freshman orientation," Maggie groaned. "I told Dean Fisher I'd be on the pre-planning committee way last spring and forgot about it till she wrote me last week. We don't meet till tomorrow, but I thought I'd get here a day early and get the good closet before Sister does for once. It is a tomb, isn't it? Who else is here?"
Tactfully, Maggie didn't ask Delia why she was in Randolph 5 days before the summer quarter started. Seeing a shoe-in for every campus queenhood that didn't involve scholastic merit when they had rushed her 2 autumns before, the Kappas had pledged Delia before she could bat her indigo Jane Powell eyes and had spent the time since trying to keep her off academic probation. She had, Maggie knew, flunked sophomore English again last spring. This summer was her last chance. She'd stayed on at the Kappa house between quarters to be tutored by a young English instructor named Tucker. Looking at the delicate blue stains under Delia's eyes and the fading strawberry hickey on her fragile neck, Maggie knew who had been tutoring whom in what, and sighed. The Kappas would have to put her on inactive if she didn't make her grades this summer, which meant she couldn't be run for homecoming queen next fall. Delia was pinned to Jenks Foley, who was Randolph's head cheerleader. She'd have had homecoming queen made in the shade. No way, she thought now, and sighed.
Who's here? Maggie asked. Oh, M.A., who came back a week early so the bird wouldn't be by herself and burn the house down, and so she could hug me goodnight when I came in from studying with Tuck and see if I'd been drinking. And the dummies like me who have to study and the wheels like you have to plan stuff for freshmen. God, I'm glad you're here, or M.A. would rat on me to the WSGA for smelling like beer last night, and I'd get kicked out instead of just flunking out. And then the Burbs here, of course, and still asleep. Her iced tea smelled like a Jack Daniel's distillery at lunch. Oh, no, Maggie giggled, clapping a hand to her forehead. Tonight she'll have a migraine. No, she'll be worn out from the carpet men coming this morning and have to take a cat nap. They fell into a huddle of laughter. What I was going to tell you, Tuck and I are going to Phoenix City tonight. Come, go, she'll never know. Delia, I can't. And you'll be out on your butt if M.A. finds out. And what's this Tuck business anyway? Jenks would have a hissy. Oh, Tuck. Delia dismissed the Randolph faculty from instructor to president with a wave of her hand. Besides, what can M.A. do? Tell the WSGA? You're the president. Come on, Maggie. There's nobody on campus to see you, and that freshman stuff isn't till tomorrow, and Boots isn't back yet. She looked quickly at Maggie's sleeveless blouse for the diamond Kappa Alpha pin that should be there, just below and to the left of Maggie's Kappa pin. It was. So you couldn't have a date anyway. We're going to Ma Beachy's. Tuck says there's a woman there that can pick up a Dixie cup with her you know what. Come on, Maggie, you're going to end up just as square as M.A. if you don't do something just a little awful once in a while. And I've got a key to the sun porch door. Come on here. Maggie looked out her window over the line of neat Kappa garbage cans in the backyard. The afternoon seemed stuck at 3:45. Shadows had not lengthened, nor sound seeped through the wall of shimmering heat. There was no one in sight. Sure, said Maggie, stumping her pall mall. Why not? On the tiny stage, a ripened and burst woman in a G-string and a lei of plastic cherry blossoms was doing incredible things with a maraschino cherry impaled on a swizzle stick. There was a lump of artificial cherries bobbling insanely at the point where the G-string disappeared between her loose white thighs, and another clump poised on the nipple of each long breast. Standing still, she looked like a grimy snow woman. In motion, she was stunningly obscene. Her professional name was Miss Cherry Delight, and she did her act to the sliding, insinuating strains of Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. Since the song had hit the top 10 the previous year, she had been the 10 o'clock featured attraction at Ma Beachy's. The take from the soldiers stationed at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, just across the river, had tripled. Maggie, chewing the plastic straw in her Tom Collins, watched Miss Cherry Delight from under her eyelashes, her face slightly averted, a skewed smile of fabricated worldly amusement pinned rigidly on her mouth. She had worn the same expression when Rhett Butler had carried Scarlett O'Hara up the endless stairs into the pulsing red bed-concealing darkness when she had gone to see a revival of Gone with the Wind with a date in high school. Maggie was sincerely and deeply embarrassed by Miss Cherry Delight and what she was doing to the maraschino cherry. Tuck, owlish and thickly precise from a succession of neat bourbons chased with beer, was propped in his chair by the silver-painted wall at his back and Delia's bare brown shoulder on his right. Charles Peyton Tucker had thick, horn-rimmed glasses and a shock of dark hair that slid limply into his eyes. He wore it, and the glasses, so as not to be confused with the crew-cut and back-buckled young men he flogged earnestly through sophomore literature. Tuck was 26 but looked younger, with a blind, vulnerable face. He was a graduate of Boston University. He had thought to bury himself gratefully in the gentle bog of a good small New England college where he would brew Earl Grey tea for small groups of students in some dim, bayed, book-lined room overlooking a quadrangle. He would publish a little. The Russians were his specialty. And he would marry, eventually, one of the Shetlanded, intense young women who knew how to pour tea as well as appreciate Gogol. Instead, he had found himself at Randolph with vast shuffling classes full of bored young Southerners who thought perhaps Gogol was a freshman fullback from Gary, Indiana. The bulk of the faculty thought him snobbish and pretentious. The heat overwhelmed and disoriented him. He thought often that he was growing decadent in it,
languid and rotted, like a character in a Somerset Maugham novel. He blamed his helpless involvement with Delia Curry on the heat, but in truth he was a sitting target for Delia. Delia had devoured his frail, tentative complexity in a single bite on the first night of their tutoring, without compunction or even thought. Delia was not embarrassed by Miss Cherry Delight, neither was she entertained. After her first technical interest in the several talents of the stars, the tassel woman, the lady with the fluorescent hands painted on her body that glowed when the black light spots hit her, the woman with the tattered and drugged-looking boa constrictor had waned. Delia had dismissed them all as fat, tacky old cows. Delia wanted to dance. The room was jammed with lean, prowling-eyed young soldiers, cool and mean and languid in droves, whistling and stamping and calling out matter-of-fact obscenities to the uninterested strippers. They were drinking hard. No beer now, not at Ma's. Just the house hard stuff. No one was mean drunk, fight drunk, yet, but the chemistry of an evening is a delicate and unpredictable thing. The manager of Ma Beachy's ran a practiced eye over the house. He looked over to the table in the corner where the little blonde was. She had come in about 8, with the booky-looking cat and the tall, quiet girl in white. The manager's eye kept going to the girl in white. She was oddly, hypnotically beautiful in the fetid gloom. She was so obviously out of her element, so stiffly cool, so not to be touched that there was an intense provocativeness about her. But every other eye in the house was on the little blonde. She had danced once with the guy in glasses. He was awkward and a little drunk, and it was easy to see that the humping sexual rhythm was distasteful to him. But the blonde... God, thought the manager, that's not decent, even in this place. They had sat down at the end of the record, but not before all the eyes had been slowly, palpably, and explicitly over the blonde's body. She had given them back the look in a slow, violet sweep around the room, and from then on the manager had known that the night could go any way at all. He hoped the guy with the glasses would get so drunk they would have to leave soon. But no. A tall, tight-faced, red-haired corporal got up, put a coin into the jukebox, pressed a button. The velvet Presley smirk uncoiled into the room. Well, since my baby left me, found a new place to dwell, down at the end of Lonely Street at Heartbreak Hotel. Weaving a little, never taking his eyes off her, jeered brashly by the whole room, the corporal walked to the table in the corner. He held out his hand to the blonde silently. Silently she rose and followed him onto the dance floor. Tuck regarded Delia and the corporal morosely. "La belle dame sans merci," he said carefully. "Look at them, Maggie. Two fossils. Two perfect throwbacks." Tuck's drink came and he took a deep swallow. He leaned closer toward her across the table, reached out and touched her cheek with the dripping tip of his swizzle stick. He was noticeably drunk. Maggie turned desperately to look over her shoulder at Delia and the corporal. They were swaying, glued together, their feet not moving, to the great pretender. Maggie saw suddenly that he had been right about them. They did look like superb, healthy animals from another age. "I must be getting drunk," she thought. "I want to go home."
"Actually, I know more about you than you think I do," Tuck was confiding, leaning far over into her face. "I know that Claiborne kid you go around with. I had him in a class a couple of years ago. He's a toad. Maggie the cat. A tall, beautiful, spoiled, rich Mississippi toad with a toad's brain. Maggie the cat. I flunked him. I suppose you'll marry him and go live with Big Mama and Big Daddy on the Delta, won't you?"
"Boots is not stupid," Maggie flared. "If he flunked your class, it makes me wonder what kind of a teacher you are. I think I want to go now."
"He's stupid and you're a fool." "Ah, shit."
Tuck drew back and drained his drink. She thought he had tired of baiting her, but he went on.
I read an article you wrote last winter for the Senator. That thing you did after Authorine Lucy enrolled at the university. It was a surprise, Maggie. It was a piece of simplistic manure, but it was the only positive thing I read in all the yellow journalism that came out about that poor, stupid Negro. Maggie the nigger lover. What did your good Kappa sister say about that article, Maggie? What did your barefoot Mississippi boy say? I'll bet it made Big Mama and Big Daddy beat their feet in the Mississippi mud, and not in down-home joy, either. You better not let the sun set on your head in Yaknapatawpha County, Maggie. Maggie flushed redder. The article had been one of her weekly columns for the student newspaper. She had been a feature writer for the Senator since her sophomore year and was made feature editor at the beginning of her junior year. The columns were fun for Maggie and easy for her. They were facile, flowing, amusing small things, their uniform innocuousness effectively masking Maggie's one real gift, a rich, glinting virtuosity with words. Since her gift was accompanied with no perceptible profundity, originality of thought, or insight, Maggie did not know she had it. She would not have acknowledged it if she had known. Writing was simply too easy. It was part of the inevitable bounty that flowed when one followed the rules. It was almost a trick she pulled on the world. Maggie thought, vaguely, that she would do something in advertising when she graduated. Meanwhile, she wrote her columns much as she rolled her socks and bought Bass Weegans. One did. She wrote them, usually in a scant half hour on the day they were due, neat little weekly essays on the honor system, the successful basketball team, or late co-ed permission for pep rallies. Once in a while, out of boredom or a vestigial sense of duty, she ventured into world affairs. Maggie was as effectively insulated from the world outside Randolph as her peers. These columns were not successful. The Authorine Lucy column was not a political column, nor a moral one. Maggie had not been aware of the politics or the morality of the situation. Her ideas about Negroes had never been examined. She had thought about them seldom and without curiosity. She loved a few of them and knew none of them. The column had been a quixotic trifle praising the Randolph student body for not rushing over to Tuscaloosa and joining the fray surrounding the entrance of the university's first Negro student. Maggie had not been talking about civil rights, only student reaction. "I don't think anybody even read it," she told Tuck sullenly. "I read it," he said. And then suddenly, "Maggie, you ought to get out of here." "I'm ready whenever you all are." "No, out of Randolph. There's nothing in that southern fried playpen for you." No one had ever told Maggie she should get out of anything, only into things. The world that had seemed to fit her like her sleek skin took on a slight, queer skew. She wanted to probe, to nibble at this alien insight as you do an ulcer on the inside of your mouth, but she wanted far more not to. "I don't know what you mean," she said. Whatever he might have replied was lost in a scuffle of feet and chairs from the dance floor and the following glissando of outrage. They swiveled. The red-haired corporal was swaying like a white pine in a high gale. His feet were planted apart. His face was furious, blind, contorted. One enormous hand was closed around the biceps of a smaller, swarthy soldier whose legs were bent in a feral crouch, whose free arm was drawn back and ended in a sunburned fist. The corporal's other hand was snapped to Delia's upper arm so tightly that his fingers dug white pits into her flesh. Delia was scrabbling at his hand with both of hers, pulling away from the two men, whimpering in fear. Black Maybelline streaked her cheeks. "Tuck, please, go get her. They're going to have a fight." Maggie pushed at him, angry at him. He jerked away from her hands, overturning his drink, which flooded across the formica into her lap. "I don't give a good goddamn if they pull her apart." A wordless, atavistic, savage sound swelled in the room. Rose burst into killing words. The crowd was forming camps, choosing sides. Another man was there suddenly, a short, thick man in bagging blue pants and a white short-sleeved nylon shirt. He was powerfully built. His chest and shoulders were massive and his arms were very long. His eyes were the white blue of opaque ice, and there was a ring of white around the irises that flashed in the dark, giving him a look of tightly capped intensity, of trance-like purpose, or of madness. He moved quickly between the dark soldier and the corporal. "Somebody better get them out of here," the thick man said to the room at large, into a sudden deadness of silence. "The managers called the MPs." The room came alive again. Two soldiers materialized beside the corporal, each taking a slack arm. The dark soldier, surrounded by his own supporting coterie of khaki, followed. In a muted scramble and scuffling of feet and chairs, they were gone. The civilian loomed abruptly beside Maggie. He had Delia by her wrist. She was blank with shock. Her mouth was puffed and worn clean of lipstick. Around it, a ring of smeared Persian melon and beard abrasion bloomed feverishly. "Come on out of here," said the civilian to Maggie. "Come on, move it, Mac. The cops will be right behind the MPs. There's a door back there to the alley. My car's out there." Maggie felt as though she were trying to move underwater. "Will you move?" He shoved Delia into Maggie's arms and hauled Tuck to his feet. Supporting him by the collar of his jacket, he herded them before him. They burst out into the heavy night air, stumbled down a weed-nested concrete block that served as a step, and fell heavily against the fender of a Thunderbird. "I'm not getting into any car," Maggie said. He gave her a violent shove, and she fell into the back seat of the Thunderbird. Another shove, and Delia came flying into the car, beginning to sob audibly. The short man slammed the door, opened the door opposite the driver's seat, and half threw, half pushed Tuck in. He shrugged into the driver's seat, and the engine came alive. "Where are we going? What do you want with us?" Maggie's voice was high and fragile with anger and fear. Delia sprawled across her, crying monotonously. "We're going away from here," the man tossed back at her over his shoulder. His voice was flat and harsh and angry also, southern, but with something else in it. "I'm trying to keep the stupid bunch of you out of trouble. What did you think I wanted with you, your warm white body?"
"Oh, wait!"
"What the hell for?"
"We forgot to pay."
The short man laughed. It was a curiously gay, young sound. He was still laughing as he turned the Thunderbird into the red and blue and green freshet of Phoenix City's main street. "You go to Randolph." It was a statement, not a question. They were drinking coffee in a back booth at an all-night truck stop on the road to Randolph. They had driven in silence, punctuated only by an occasional snorting giggle from Tuck and hiccuping sobs from Delia. By the time he had found the truck stop, Delia had stopped crying and begun to prod Maggie and whisper,
"Who's he? Where are we going?"
Maggie had ignored her. Tuck had fallen against the door and slept, snoring. "Yes, I'm Margaret Deloche." She wondered why she had not said Maggie. "And this is Delia Curry." Delia had borrowed Maggie's purse and gone to the restroom. She had washed the Maybelline off her face, combed her gilt hair, and applied a ripe layer of Maggie's fire and ice. She gave the dark man a radiant smile.
"You are a hero, I declare. I think they would have killed me. I never thought..."
"Yes, you did. I was watching you all night. You're lucky somebody isn't dead. Like that poor son of a bitch in the car out there. What in God's name were you doing in that place?" He was looking at Maggie.
"I don't know that that's any of your business, Mr.
Cunningham. Hoyt Cunningham. You're not being very cordial to somebody who just kept you from being kicked out of school, am I right?" Maggie smiled unwillingly. "To put it mildly, thanks, Mr. Cunningham. Hoyt, we have no business in Phoenix City, and we're going to be mighty lucky if we can get back in the house without somebody finding out. Got any more bright ideas, Delia?" Delia dimpled. She was back on firm footing.
"You're an awful square, Maggie."
She looked at Hoyt through the tangle of newly blackened eyelashes.
"She's president of the WSGA, the Women's Student Government Association, yet. We're safe as bugs in a rug. Maggie just doesn't have any spirit of adventure. I can tell you've got a real spirit of adventure, Hoyt."
He didn't answer her. He looked at Maggie, a level, unfriendly look. "Well, Madam President, I hope your little foray into the wild side of life was worth it. That was stupid. That's a really crummy place." A dose of the clap is about the mildest thing you can get out of there with. You little college girls, honest to God, you don't know your asses from first base. Maggie was suddenly very angry again. If it's that bad, what were you doing there? Believe it or not, I was working. I work for the AP, the Associated Press, the Southeastern Bureau out of Atlanta. There's been some trouble at Benning lately with the Negroes. Started after Nat King Cole was over there in a concert last month. The whites booed him pretty bad, and there was one hell of a fight. Things have been pretty tense ever since. I'm doing a kind of in-depth piece on race relations around the southeastern bases. There's something really big and bad piling up, something that's going to last a long time.
If you mean that bus thing in Montgomery, that thing that Dr. What's his name? King? That Negro preacher? That's not anything, said Delia. They don't do anything but sing and not ride the buses. And who cares if they don't? It's white people and newspaper people from up north that are stirring it all up anyway. And communists. They'll get tired and go home before long. You think it's going to blow over? Well, Daddy says it is. Delia was bored with the conversation and uneasy, both at his messianic blue stare and the implicit criticism in his words. Maggie did a piece on the niggers, she said. She wrote a column on that Negro girl who tried to get in the university last year. She's feature editor of the Randolph Senator, too.
What do you think about Authorine Lucy going to Alabama, Maggie?
Nothing. I don't think anything.
I'm sick of the whole thing. What is there to think?
I mean, she was expelled about 2 months later. I believe the Negroes have the right to go to school wherever they want to. I just don't understand why anybody would want to go somewhere where everybody hated them so much. There are good Negro colleges, Tuskegee and the Atlanta University complex. What kind of life could she have had in Tuscaloosa?
You really don't understand, do you?
No. Maybe you'll tell me, since you obviously know so much.
I'm talking about revolution, Maggie. Pure revolution like they had in Russia in 1917. With riots and shootouts and burning and killing, the whole social structure of this country is going to be torn to pieces and rebuilt. Negroes are not going to be oppressed much longer. It's going to be a long, bloody, goddamn fight, and you're right in the middle of the vanguard. You're living with history.
Delia said suddenly, Are you a communist? You don't sound like a Southerner. And you work for a newspaper?
His laugh exploded. I work for a wire service, and I was born and raised in Greenville, Mississippi, right in the middle of God's little acre. You can't get any more Southern than that. If I sound like a Yankee, it's because I went to school at Columbia and I worked in the North for a year or two. And I spent a little time at Harvard. I was a Nieman Fellow.
A what?
It doesn't matter. Delia brightened.
Greenville? I bet you know Maggie's boyfriend, Boots Claybone. Boots' daddy is just everything in the Delta, and they've got tons of money. Maggie's going to be a rich lady.
Hoyt gave Maggie a long look. Sure, I know Boots, he said. I went to school with him. He's a little younger than I am. You going to marry him, Miss Maggie?
I'm just pinned to him. I don't know if we'll get married or not.
But she had known it vaguely, hadn't she? She thought they would probably get married eventually, after she had worked a while in Atlanta in advertising and he had settled into a place in his father's affairs. She realized that she did not know precisely what those affairs were, and that she had looked no further than the flower-banked altar of the Lytton First Methodist Church. She felt stampeded and obdurate, and the skewed strangeness was back.
I haven't decided what I'm going to do yet, she said.
Well, you're really spastic, Delia chirped. If you don't want him, I know about 1,000 people who do. Me, for one, I think he's gorgeous.
I think he's rich, said Hoyt. He'll be one of the richest men in the Delta when the old man kicks off. Think about it, Maggie. You'd have an honest-to-God antebellum plantation, complete with an army of loyal retainers. The Claibornes haven't gotten the word about the Emancipation Proclamation yet. You could sit on the veranda and fan and drink mint juleps and never have to lift a finger again. Of course, I'd advise you to give up integrationist journalism.
The Claibornes are wonderful to their help, said Maggie stiffly. Boots told me there are several of the old ones who can't work anymore, and his father lets them have their cabins. Their houses, free, and gives them money to live on. He sent two of the younger ones through Tuskegee. Boots' family is probably better to the Negroes than anybody you've ever met.
This is the end of side one.
Well, well, old Boots, you'll be a real ornament to Greenville society. I'll drop by when I'm in the neighborhood if you'll give me house room by then. Is Booth coming back for summer school?
He'll be back tomorrow.
Well, sure, I forgot. Boots is a regular on the summer school circuit, isn't he? Maybe I'll drop by the K.A. house and see him when I'm through over at Benning. See if he's still the same old rich, beautiful Boots I remember.
Maggie slammed her empty cup on the oilcloth. You were very nice to get us out of there. We owe you for that. But I don't have to sit here and listen to you knock my fiancé and my mind and the way I think about things. I didn't ask for your opinion. I don't know you from Adam's house cat, and I don't want to know you any better. And if you would be so kind as to drive us back to that place, we'll get Tuck's car and go home. We must be boring you to death.
Did anybody ever tell you you're very pretty when you're mad, as the man said, when you're not mad, too? He was laughing again. The bright child's laugh.
Oh, shut up!
He flipped some coins on the table and followed her out of the truck stop. Come on, I'll drive you back to Randolph. We're almost halfway there now. Tuck can get somebody to bring him back for his car tomorrow.
Don't bother,
said Maggie. It'll be my pleasure. They drove the 9 miles back to Randolph in another silence. When they pulled up to the back parking lot of the Kappa house, it was 3 a.m., Maggie shook Delia awake and pushed her out of the back seat.
Thank you,
she said briefly to Hoyt. He did not get out of the car. You're welcome. Maybe I'll see you again. We can start from scratch. We sort of got off on the wrong foot.
I doubt it.
She was halfway up the sun porch when she stopped and looked back. He had not started the car. He looked at her whitely from the lowered window.
What were you doing in that place? She said.
His laugh came up the path to meet her.
Why, I went to see the Berlick you,
just like you. It was 9:30 on the first Saturday night of the summer session, and the Kappa Alpha veranda pulsed and boomed and keened and squalled with the amplified efforts of the crew cuts rendering shaboom. The bulk of the chapter and their dates were dovetailed onto the patio. Beyond the veranda, the lawn was dark, illumined in the blackest pockets with chalk smears of white shirts and the red periods of cigarettes. In the farthest corner of the backyard, on a stone bench beside the Cape Jessamine hedge, Maggie pushed Boots away from her slightly and sat up straighter.
Don't, Boots. It's too hot and I'm all smeared.
He laughed lazily. He had a soft, deep laugh that rarely rose above a chuckle or showed his teeth. All the Kappas considered Boots very sexy. He had been lounging and cool and sleepy-eyed long before Rebel without a cause. I'm the one that's smeared. You're costing me a damn fortune in laundry bills. But I'd rather have good loving any day than clean shirts any day of the week. He slurred shirts slightly. He had been drinking since late afternoon. He pulled her against him again and slid his hand down the neck of her dress under the rigid cup of the strapless brassiere.
Don't, Boots!
What have you got under that damn padded thing that's so goddamn priceless? For Christ's sake, I've been pinned to you for over a year and you've never even let me touch him. Every one of your precious Kappa sisters that's pinned over here has gone all the way at least once. But not Miss Iceberg of 1956, not even one little feel. I don't think you've got any. He flung away from her sullenly and pulled a cigarette out of his pocket and lit it. Until he had met Maggie, Boots Claiborne had not been accustomed to feminine rebuffs. His sexual prowess with the languid girls of the Delta had been a legend that preceded him to Randolph, and his career since was even more storied. His reputation had frightened Maggie when she met him at the Kappa Alpha's Old South Ball at the end of her sophomore year. But she had been dazzled by his long-boned, leonine grace and his cat's movements. In his gray Confederate officer's uniform, he looked like Leslie Howard as Ashley Wilkes. From the first, he treated her with an air of grave, protective, exaggerated courtesy that charmed and soothed her. Almost from the first, too, Maggie realized that Boots was a totally conventional creature. He might bed with glee any number of girls whom he could not quite envision on the dazzling steps of Groveland. The girl who wore his pin would, in the last analysis and despite the damp fumblings and ritual sulks, be saved for a carved bed in some upstairs Mississippi bedroom off a wrought-iron guarded gallery. He was, moreover, usually passed out cold behind the Kappa Alpha house or in the party room by 10:30 of a weekend evening. Maggie's virtue was safe. "I met somebody who knows you," she said.
"Who?"
He looked restlessly toward the punch tub.
"Hoyt Cunningham.
I haven't seen him in 5 or 6 years.
Where'd you meet him?"
"Well, I let Delia talk me into going over to Ma Beach's last week. She got herself into the middle of a fight between 2 soldiers, you know Delia, and he was there and broke it up and got us out of there. We had some coffee and talked, and then he brought us back to the house. It was nice of him, but I don't like him, Boots. He's funny."
"He always was.
What the hell were you doing at Ma's? What was he doing there?"
"He was doing a story for the AP on the soldiers over at Benning. Something about the Negroes after a King Cole concert, and he was just there drinking beer."
"He make a pass at you?"
"Oh, no. I mean, he just seemed to think all of us down here were stupid and wouldn't recognize that there was even a problem with the Negroes. And he talked like we still beat the slaves every night after supper. He sounded like he wanted a revolution.
But no, he didn't make a pass at me."
"Well, he wouldn't if he knew you were my girl," Boots said comfortably.
"He may be full of shit. There's not going to be any revolution, not in Mississippi. Our Negroes have it good. They don't want to go to school with us any more than we want them to. And they should have got on going to fight any of us. Too scared of the Klan. Hoyt always did have his head full of liberal shit and his nose in a book. But he's pretty much a good old boy. His folks aren't real quality, but they sure aren't poor white trash either. He wouldn't bird dog my girl."
Well, don't be too sure about that, Maggie thought, remembering the intense white-ringed eyes on her and the remark he made about seeing her again.
"He's not quite the Mississippi gentleman you think he is," she said perversely. "He said some pretty sarcastic things about your family. You too, for that matter."
"You wouldn't be baited."
"Well, I never said he was a gentleman. Hoyt's daddy runs one of my daddy's sawmills. His mother's a school teacher. They never did have a pot to piss in. It was daddy that arranged for him to go to that school up north, got Ed Copeland over at the bank to lend him the money when nobody else would. Mississippi folks don't like to be beholden. He owes the Claibornes, and he knows it, and it frosts him. He was just blown off."
Maggie was mulishly reluctant to drop it. "He says he's going to come over and see you this summer."
"Let him. Come on, there's your song."
The overripe voice of Gogie Grant sobbed into the wayward wind, and they got up from the bench and moved into the light of the veranda.
"Mr. Loesch, since you insist upon polluting the rarefied atmosphere of my classroom with a noxious weed, I insist that you pass me that pack so that I may do the same." Professor Bennett G. Flournoy, whose specialties were contemporary poetry and fiction, rarely had large classes, and so they tended to the informal. Maggie's contemporary poetry class at 11 a.m. in the Semmes Hall was composed of 6 junior and senior girls and 1 pale, silent boy in library science. Ben Flournoy liked his smaller classes of upperclassmen girls. The Deloche girl was coming alive like a parched vine in a showery April. She was going to be a weeper, though. Her eyes had filled when he read them Hardy's Afterward. He did not want Margaret Deloche to lose the first green shoots of order and insight that he glimpsed among the florid tangle of her mind. A few tears would water them. Many would rot the roots. She had, he knew from reading her column in the Senator, a rich facility with words but few perceptions. So he needled her when she wept. There is some difference in her, he thought, watching Maggie drift out with a tall girl from New Jersey named Aiken Reed. I don't know what it is yet, but I hope I can find it before the summer is out. It would be fine to help her use it. Otherwise, I think it could destroy her.
"I think Professor Flournoy has a lecture for you, Maggie," said Aiken Reed as they walked across the campus toward the main gate in town.
In the 3 weeks that they had had contemporary poetry together, Maggie and Aiken had fallen into the habit of having a hamburger and Coke together. He thinks I'm silly and immature. He wrote on my paper on Dover Beach that I'd started out by beginning to understand Matthew Arnold and ended up by drowning him in treacle. Well, Aiken said, he may write you notes about your mind, but I bet I know where his is, and it's not in your head, it's in your pants. Aiken! Aiken gave her a lazy grin. She was tall and drooping and slender and beautiful, really beautiful, with fine bones and a pure, carved face and misted gray eyes. Her skin was faintly dusted with gold all year long, and her clothes were legendary on the campus. Aiken's father was a prominent man in Upper Montclair, said to be very wealthy. Aiken was an enigma. She had come to Randolph because it had a good school of interior design, she said, and because the South had always fascinated her. The girls who did not like her, and most did not, even her Pi Beta Phi sisters, were quick to point out that, if she wanted to study design, Pratt and Parsons were right there, or her father could have sent her to any school she chose, even to Europe. The majority of girls said that she was a nymphomaniac and had to leave Upper Montclair so as not to jeopardize her parents' social position, and that Randolph was as far away and as strict a school as her parents could find. This was not true either, but it was closer. Aiken slept openly with whomever she chose and seemed to feel no shame about it. Rather, she enjoyed it. Aiken dated no one regularly, but was currently sleeping with a fifth-year architecture student in his garage apartment after his afternoon lab, and beginning a liaison with a 40-ish bachelor professor of political science. Aiken had not finished with the subject of Professor Flournoy. "He's a very attractive man, I think," she said. "I had dinner over at their house last weekend. Corky took me over there." Corky was Professor Harold Corcoran, the political science professor. Maggie did not know what to reply. She felt naive, outdone, and vaguely envious. "What was his wife like?" "Nice, not very pretty, but awfully interesting. Before Corky and I left, Keita took me in the kitchen and said she knew it was none of her business, but they were very fond of Corky and they liked me, and she knew how stuffy the school was about undergraduates seeing faculty members, and she knew a doctor in Columbus who'd fit me with a diaphragm if I wasn't prepared." "Prepared? That's exactly what she said. Isn't that quaint?" "But it was very nice of her."
"What did you tell her?"
"I told her I had one. I'd be a fool if I didn't, wouldn't I?"
Maggie flushed and Aiken laughed.
"There was somebody else there I wanted to ask you about," said Aiken, patting her Rachel Helena Rubinstein over her flawless nose.
"Who?"
"Charles Tucker. He's an instructor in English from the north somewhere. He was there by himself. I don't think he's been here very long."
"Why ask me about him?"
Maggie was instantly alert. It would not do to have the Randolph faculty talking about the night in Phoenix City. "Damn Tuck," she thought.
"He said he met you one night before the quarter started."
"Oh, well, yes, we had coffee one night. He's tutoring one of my sorority sisters, Delia Curry. She's a stupid little twat who's going to get herself and probably somebody else in trouble if she keeps parading herself in front of half of Fort Benning at Ma Beachy's. I don't know why the Kappas don't put a stop to that, or that cretin cheerleader she's pinned to. She acts so innocent, but she's just half-whore."
Maggie winced at Aiken's language, and then she smiled.
"I know," Aiken smiled back, "the pot calling the kettle. The difference is I'm honest, Maggie, and I don't tease. Anyway, this Tuck character is interesting in a way. He seems so lost or something."
"He may be interesting and lost, but he surely ought to have more sense than blab that in front of half the faculty. It could get him in just as bad hot water as it could Delia and me."
"Well, Corky and the Flournoys certainly aren't going to talk about it. Ben, Professor Flournoy, thought it was funny. He said he'd have given a lot to see the Lady of the Lake in the middle of a fight at Ma Beachy's."
"Did he mean me? Oh, God, how can I go back in his class and look him in the face when he knows?"
"Oh, Maggie, he said it affectionately, sort of.
He thinks very highly of you.
He said you had untapped reserves of, I forget, but it was very complimentary. He said a taste of real life wouldn't hurt you at all, but the Tuck should have had more sense than to take you over there."
"Well, I can take care of myself," I'm all right. I'm right here, aren't I? Thanks to some perfect stranger. Who was he? Oh, some newsman who's doing a story over at Fort Benning. Boots knows him. Interesting? No. Rude and opinionated. Too bad. You could do a whole lot better than Boots, Maggie. Though he is rather beautiful. I've often thought he'd probably be fabulous in bed if you didn't have to make conversation with him afterward. Have you... Aiken, you aren't really interested in Tuck, are you? Maggie said hastily. Boots and bed were subjects she did not wish to fall under the merciless, pure spotlight of Aiken's attention. He really is involved with Delia. He's got the hots for her, that's all, and he thinks it's some kind of tortured spiritual thing. I wonder if a real whole woman would scare him to death. Meaning you? Why not? Aiken, you be careful. I'm a big girl, hadn't you heard? I thought the whole campus had. The Kappa Alpha Summer House Party was held every year over the long 4th of July holiday in Destin, Florida, a Mediterranean-looking little jumble of shrimping piers, tourist cottages and motels, and peeling whiteboard seafood restaurants some 40 miles up the coast from Panama City. There was one motel large enough to accommodate the Kappa Alphas and their dates in some propriety, a half moon of terracotta cottages facing the beach and gulf across a soul-searing ribbon of black macadam highway. At high noon on the Sunday of the summer house party, Maggie lay spread-eagled under the punishing fist of the sun on a beach towel. She would not, she knew, burn. By the next day she would be burnished and golden and sleek and look exotic and vivid. She had brought a lot of white things to accent this. Her fiercely boned and draped swimsuit was white, and her short shorts, which she would wear into Panama City in the evening to dance and drink at the hangout. She would roll them still higher up her mahogany thighs. Delia, next to her, fidgeted peevishly under the sun. The seashore was not kind to her. Her smooth cap of hair, so carefully coaxed into silver gilt by lemon juice and peroxide under the gentlest spring sun in Alabama, went limp and hung in twin-like hanks in the heavy, hot sea wind, and the salt water turned it into faint but unmistakable chartreuse. Delia thought longingly of the night, when she would shine like a Dresden figurine in the smoky murk of the hangout and could dance. A shower of sand spumed over them, as if a small mortar shell had hit the beach. Boots and Jenks stood at the towel's edge, shaking seawater from their glistening bodies like sleek-coated animals. Maggie was struck, as she often was when she saw them together, by their similarity. Jenks Foley was from North Alabama, in the strange, stark hill country that seemed unlike Alabama or any other part of the South Maggie knew. His father worked at the Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, coming home on weekends to his family in the lunar little town where Jenks' mother was postmistress, and where his two younger brothers toiled taciturnly at their high school science and physics books, the more quickly to follow their father out of town and into outer space. Even his closest friends in the fraternity, Boots was one of them, had to concede that Jenks was not overly long on brains, but there was a simple sweetness to him, a morning fresh and dimensionless ingenuousness that charmed almost everyone who met him. He was physically very like Boots, with a long, graceful body and a thatch of near-white hair only slightly blanched by peroxide, and he wore it brushed close to his head and parted down the side, as did Boots, eschewing the near-universal crew cut. He was long-legged, long-waisted, powerful through the shoulders, and beautiful in motion. The KAs had hoped to have a quarterback in Jenks when they pledged him, but he had been loungingly loath to train and became Randolph's head cheerleader by a landslide student vote in his sophomore year. He had held this sovereign post ever since. He had a quick white grin and very blue eyes and was unlike Boots temperamentally, which did not affect their friendship. Their talk did not run deep. He and Delia looked like a matched set.
"Hey, babe," he said now to Delia. "Come on, get my favorite fanny wet. You've been sitting here like a bump on a log all morning. Can't have you getting the body burnt."
"Go on, Jenks, you're dripping on my hair. I don't want to go in right now, it's too hot. Can't we ride down the beach and get a Coke?"
"Got something better than that up in the room," said Boots, sprawling down beside Maggie on her towel. "Maggie, baby,
Why don't you and Delia go up and bring down that cooler for us? We made a batch of purple Jesus fresh first thing this morning. It ought to be just right by now.
On an empty stomach? Oh, no thanks, said Maggie. I don't feel like moving. Send a pledge. Besides, you drank enough of that stuff to kill a horse last night. You're going to be an alcoholic by the time you're 30.
Purple Jesus won't hurt you. He ruffled her hair. It just makes you piss purple. You're going to be a first-rate nag by the time you're 30. There's no such thing as alcoholics or nagging women on the Delta. Not allowed.
Tough. I guess I'll just have to get along somewhere beside the famous Delta. Maggie was suddenly cross and hot.
Come on, y'all. We're having a party. And it's yardarm time. Speaking of pissing, I'll go get the stuff. I need to take a leak anyway.
Jenks uncurled himself from Delia's towel and shambled amiably away across the sand toward the road.
Nothing like a house party to make a guy take a leak, Boots said, settling back with one of Maggie's cigarettes. It's not like he didn't have a whole ocean out there.
My, aren't we elegant this morning, Maggie snapped.
He scowled at her. I don't know what's the matter with you this morning, Maggie, but you're about as much fun as a preacher in a whorehouse. What you need is a belt of purple Jesus and a good ducking, in that order.
Jenks came back, staggering under the weight of the cooler. He dropped it into the sand and produced paper cups. His purple-ringed grin testified that he had sampled the punch.
Woo-wee!
He belched and rubbed his hard brown stomach.
That's good stuff! Here, Boots, Maggie.
He doled out Dixie cups.
Here, sugar. Best sunburn remedy in the world.
Boots and Jenks drained their cups and Maggie sipped at hers. Delia rooted hers in the sand and pulled a pink terry cloth beach jacket over her suit.
Hey, said Jenks. It's Sunday morning and here we are boozing it up on the beach. Here's to sin.
This ain't sin, it's communion, said Boots. Purple Jesus is just the thing for communion. This is my blood that I shed for thee.
Boots, that's sacrilege.
Maggie shoved at him. The purple liquid went flying out of his cup, coming down in a gaudy shower across Delia.
Oh, Boots, damn it, just look at what you've done, she wailed. All over my suit and my hair. Oh, shit, that stuff doesn't come out.
Jenks rose in a single liquid movement and scooped Delia up and off her towel. He ran with her, stumbling across the beach toward the lackadaisical surf. Delia shrieked and beat at him with her small fist.
Jenks, I don't want to get my hair wet! Jenks, don't you dare!
Her shrill voice stopped abruptly as he lost his balance and fell with her into a breaking wave. Both yellow heads disappeared into the beige foam.
That'll do it for the day, Boots predicted, refilling his cup. She'll put the freeze on him and you've got a cob up your ass and Jenks and I might as well go find us some women somewhere else down the beach.
Be my guest.
Here we go. Boots muttered as Delia emerged from the water and stalked, stiff-legged with fury, toward her towel.
Jenks trotted behind her like a chastened golden retriever.
Delia, wet, looked sodden and shrunken like a soaked baby Easter chicken. Wordlessly, she gathered up her beach bag and started off across the sand, stumbling in her effort to radiate icy hauteur and looking more chicken-like than ever from behind.
What did I do? Shit, I thought you came to the beach to go in the water.
Jenks flung himself down on Maggie's towel.
You got her hair wet, said Boots nastily. There's one thing about women you need to remember, boy. Keep 'em barefooted and keep 'em pregnant, and keep 'em in the kitchen and don't mess up their hair. It's an old Delta formula, never fails.
He smiled narrowly at Maggie.
You aren't funny, Boots, she said. She rose and assembled her own gear and started after Delia.
Where are you going?
To take a nap. It's not the hour, it's the company.
When she got to the door of the cottage, Maggie looked back down onto the beach. She picked out their blonde heads finally around the volleyball net. The cooler was there, too. She sighed. By dinner time, they would both be drunk.
What are you doing back here? I thought y'all were going to get some lunch.
Delia, emerging naked from the shower, was smooth-faced and placid again. Delia did not long maintain a passion.
Oh, they make me sick. They're so damn smug. And they'll both be knee-walking drunk by 5 o'clock. I thought I'd take a nap and read a while. I brought us some hamburgers.
Thanks,
Did you and Boots have a fight, too?
Not really. I just didn't feel like staying on the beach any longer. I'm cooked, and I hate purple Jesus.
Me, too. Was Jinx mad, do you think?
You know Jinx is never mad at you. They're too mellow on gin and grape juice to be mad. It's just that Boots is so sure of me sometimes. And I get so tired of hearing about the precious Delta. You'd think it was a kingdom or something.
Well, it is, said Delia. Maggie, sometimes I think you're crazy. I'd give anything to get married and live at Groveland.
Delia, is that really what you want to do?
Well, sure.
Delia looked at her with round indigo eyes. What else would I do? I don't know. Work, maybe. You'll have a degree in education, after all.
Maggie, you know I'd make a rotten teacher.
I'll leave the working to you and your friend Aiken Reed. Only I'll bet neither one of you ever works a day in your life.
Why not?
Well, you'll marry Boots in a June wedding with 12 bridesmaids right after you graduate, no matter what you say. And Aiken will probably marry old Tuck.
Do you care about Aiken and Tuck?
God, no! I was just fooling around till Jenks got back to school. I never thought the idiot would get serious about me.
Can you see me taking him home to Prattville to meet Mama and Daddy?
No, he's perfect for Aiken. And I hope they live happily ever after, in sin or out of it.
Listen, Maggie, he's the one who told me about them. He said he'd found a girl who really understood him and that he and I were just some bright doomed thing. He said he never meant to hurt me. He told me that the last night he tutored me.
And what did you say?
I said he only hurt me when he tried to dance with me.
Oh, Delia, that was cruel. Delia, did it ever occur to you that there's more to life than dancing?
Well, if there is, I don't want to know about it yet. Speaking of which, I think I'll take a nap before tonight. I can't wait to get to the hangout. That's the home of the Panama City Dirty Bop, you know.
She lowered the blinds against the fiery white outside and turned up the thumping window unit and curled on her side like a kitten and slept. Maggie read a chapter or two of Not as a Stranger, and then she, too, fell asleep. The hangout was not really a building. It was a pavilion facing the sea on the scabbed fringe of sand that served Panama City as a beach. Maggie and Boots and Delia and Jenks sat at a table beside the railing that gave onto the beach and ocean. It was stifling hot, even in the tepid sea wind that blew monotonously across the dance floor. They had been at the table since 7 that evening. They had stopped on the way from Destin for fried shrimp, and Maggie and Delia had gorged themselves. Boots and Jenks had drunk gin and 7-Up. They had brought a bottle of gin and were 3/4 of the way to the bottom of it. Delia was giddy and giggling from the alcohol and the amplified thumping of Elvis Presley's electric guitar. Jenks was growing steadily louder. His cheerleader's voice had lost its lilt of enthusiasm and was becoming hard-edged and truculent. Maggie had never seen him so drunk or so testy. He and Delia had quarreled steadily all the way from the Harmony House, Delia had said. Maggie and Boots had followed them in the Jaguar.
What about?
Maggie asked her in the restroom of the fried shrimp place.
About me dancing with Hoods? Jenks says the guys who hang around the hangout are mean sons of bitches and don't respect girls, and he won't have me dancing with them.
He's probably right. You know what happened at Ma's.
That was different. That was Tuck. Who's going to start anything with a whole fraternity sitting there? I told him if he couldn't handle a Panama City hood, he better get out of the ball game. I've been looking forward to this for 3 months.
The smoke and music and the sticky sweet residue of gin and 7-Up hurt Maggie's head. Maggie found rock and roll music more a convenience than a creed. It was necessary in order to dance. She accepted that. But the sound never exalted or exhilarated her, as it did so many of her contemporaries. Elvis Presley both attracted and repelled her. And while she had a number of his singles among her 45s, she had far more of the smoky, bittersweet ballads of June Christie and Chris Connor. She looked out over the ocean into the sky where a full moon sailed high among ragged clouds.
Let's go for a walk, she said to Boots.
In a minute. He had become suddenly still and was looking onto the dance floor where Jenks and Delia were dancing. They were not alone on the floor, but they might as well have been. Delia was alone in her motion, her eyes closed, her hips moving convulsively to the beat of hound dog, her legs locked stiff, her feet not moving. She looked incredibly, viscerally sexual.
and closed away under a dome of rapt self-awareness. Jenks had stopped dancing. He stood swaying slightly and watching her, his face pared to the bone with the coming trouble. He looked like a murderous baby. Maggie felt the trouble sore as if mercury were running up a thermometer. "Boots, you better go get Jenks," she began, but the tall boy was already moving out of his crowd and onto the floor, the dark hot rodder, the candidate for the mystery of Delia. He reached for her at the same time Jenks sprang. It was scrabbling and spitting and cat-like and incredibly fast. Then a swarm of Kappa Alphas were behind Jenks, pulling at his shirt, and a corresponding swarm of sun-dark arms were pulling at the rodder. No blood ran. It was a fight nobody wanted, and the antagonists allowed themselves to be jostled and soothed back to their respective tables. Lightning forked greenly into the sea, and thunder cracked and rain began. Delia knew she was in disfavor with the K.A.'s. After they had thumped Jenks on the back and put a fresh drink into his hands, they had not lingered to crow and bluster as they usually did after a fight had been averted. They had pointedly ignored Delia and gone back to their own dates, and no conversation broke out. Boots was silent, and Jenks' chin rested on his chest, his eyes on the surface of his drink. "My hero," Delia drawled dangerously into the silence. Jenks was on his feet in one furious movement. He pulled her out of her chair so abruptly that she stumbled, dropping her straw purse and scattering cigarettes, makeup, and coins onto the floor.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Her voice was thin and high.
"I'm taking you home, back to school, right now. I'm going to stop at the motel for 5 minutes flat, and if you're not through packing by then, Maggie can bring what you leave. Come on, move."
"Jenks, I don't want to go home. The party's not over. You're drunk and you can't drive like that."
"Shut up!"
It was a voice Maggie had never heard. The room watched as he tugged her, wailing across the dance floor and out the entrance. A motor roared. Except for a low swell of laughter from the other side of the pavilion, there was utter silence. Boots drained his drink and stood up. "Come on," he said to Maggie, and she gathered up Delia's purse and her own, and followed him out to the Jaguar.
"Stupid prick. Poor, dumb, stupid prick," he said once on the drive home, but that was all he did say.
They were due to go home the next day anyway, but the spine of the house party was broken, and so most of the cars were loaded early, and the caravan of sunburns and hangovers started north. Only once on the drive home had Maggie mentioned Jenks and Delia. "I hoped I got home okay. I never saw Jenks so mad, and he was pretty drunk."
"Jenks can drive better drunk than most people can sober. I bet I know one little tramp that's going to be minus a K.A. pin next time you see her."
"Oh, Boots, that was just a fight. She should have known better, but that's just Delia. You know they're crazy about each other. I can't remember a time they weren't going to be married."
"Well, they're not now, and I know. That's over."
"Boots."
"Drop it, Maggie."
And so she did. They drove for a long while in silence.
"I'm going home in a couple of weekends," Boots said. "Want to come and meet the folks?"
"I'd like to, but I'll have to ask Mother and Daddy."
He laughed. "I don't think there'll be any problem. I'll ask my mother to write yours."
"Well, that would be nice." It was past dusk when the Jaguar pulled into the parking lot of the Kappa House. Maggie could see figures outlined in the upstairs windows, gesturing with animation, and more were downstairs in the drawing room. Another group of girls stood on the veranda.
"What on earth?"
said Maggie. They got out of the car. Boots started up the flagstone path, and Maggie followed him, her arms full of Delia's abandoned belongings.
"Oh, Maggie!"
A voice wrenched shrilly from the murmur of softer ones on the veranda. A figure broke from the knot of girls and clattered down the steps.
"Oh, Maggie, I thought you'd never get back. It's so awful."
"Sister," she was crying. "What has happened?"
"It's Delia. They had a wreck. The car went into a telephone pole and she's hurt so bad. They took her up to the hospital in Montgomery and she's still unconscious."
"What about Jenks?" Boots' voice came out on a very small sigh.
Oh, dear Jesus, Jenks is dead.
The news of the accident ran through the summer campus like brush fire. In a student body of more than 7,000, there were a few tragedies each year, automobile accidents mostly. But now, in one rending pre-dawn moment, Randolph had lost its head cheerleader and, for all practical purposes, one of its legendary beauties. Delia's face, it was reported, was a featureless aspic under the white bandages. Years of plastic surgery, M.A. Appleton wept at the chapter after she and Maggie had visited the hospital. And even then she would not look like Delia, only human. She had not yet regained consciousness at the time of their visit 2 days after the K.A. house party had ended. There seemed to be little or no brain damage, though this would not be known until she awakened. She had been thrown clear, but through the windshield. Aside from a broken arm and abrasions from a long slide on the pavement, there seemed to be only nominal injury, except to her face. It was almost as though, the doctors told Delia's parents, she did not wish to wake up. Jenks had been buried in the family plot in the pitted little North Alabama town. The Kappa Alphas had gone en masse, and delegates from the major campus organizations. Maggie did not go. But a surprising number of students who had known Jenks only as a gilded figure in orange and blue, leading their Saturday litanies, did. Jenks's family, Boots told Maggie when he returned, had stood stonily silent and closed in their darkness, and had not spoken to anyone. It was just like he was a stranger to them, almost, he told Maggie. Well, Maggie thought, he was.
Maggie, honey, you go on upstairs now and take a nap. That hellion son of mine has worn you out. You've got circles an inch deep under those pretty eyes. I'll send Vinny up directly with some iced tea.
Cora Lee Claiborne gave Maggie a small shove pat, and Maggie, feeling herself dismissed like a child from the presence of an affable but distracted adult, obediently rose from the wrought-iron veranda chair and gathered up her purse and sunglasses. They had come in from a luncheon at the country club to meet Boots' pretty friend from school. I really enjoyed meeting your friends. They were so nice to me, said Maggie, one foot in the pure yellow sunlight of the veranda and one in the cave dark of the foyer.
Well, you're a sweet girl. Run on now. Boots and his daddy will be back from wherever they went before you know it, and they'll be stomping and hollering for us to come have a drink with them, and you'll be limp as a dish rag if you don't get a little nap.
She gave Boots's mother a ridiculous military little flutter of her hand and fled up the dark stairs that curved from the sea of polished floor up into the cool, cavernous upper reaches of Groveland. When she wakened, Maggie stretched and looked at her watch. 5:15. A screen door twang-thudded somewhere downstairs. Men's feet clattered imperially in the polished foyer. Men's voices rang invadingly up the stairs.
I know two women who better be down here looking pretty and drinking whiskey in 10 minutes flat.
Boots's father.
Wake up, Maggie, or I'll come up there and haul you out of that bed myself. That ain't no bad thing either.
Boots. Boots, in the company of his father, was a caricature, both of Boots and of Courtney Claiborne. Gone was the lounging grace and the sleepy cat's demeanor he wore at Randolph. What remained of Maggie's Boots was the slightly sullen complacency that emerged late in the evenings after many drinks. On his home turf, something raw, male, brawling came into Boots' face and voice. Something near primitive, simplistic, yet ingratiating. He's acting like an overgrown child, thought Maggie, taking a gin and tonic from the tray held by blank-faced Black Cleveland in a white coat. They sat in a circle in the wrought-iron chairs on the veranda. It must be close to 8 o'clock, Maggie thought. They had been drinking since 6. She had not wanted a second gin and tonic. That had been a mistake. This was a whiskey house. Even Cora Lee drank it. She was on her 4th, and her voice was growing shriller. Boots and Courtney's had roughened. They had talked of Jenks.
Goddamn awful thing, Courtney Claiborne said. Loved this old place, I remember, when Boots brought him home last spring. I rode him all over one morning while this one was still asleep. Yes, sir, he gave this place more attention in 1 weekend than this boy here does in a year. Boots here don't know any more about cotton than a jackrabbit. Thinks Santa Claus brings it. Got no head for the law, neither. What am I going to do with him, Maggie?
Maggie shifted uncomfortably. I think he knows a lot about it, Judge Claiborne, she said. He talks about Groveland all the time. He makes it sound like some kind of Shangri-La. He loves it. He's always saying Groveland is a real cotton empire that you built, she added cravenly. Help me, Boots, she said with her eyes. Help yourself.
Shangri-La, huh? Well, this old place has been good to Boots, that's for sure. Never lifted a finger to learn how to run it after he was old enough to go to school. Couldn't. He was always in summer school. Drinking and chasing tail, that's all he thinks about. Goddamn. Excuse me, sugar, I don't mean you. What's going to happen to this place after I'm gone is anybody's guess.
Now, Court, that's not so. Boots knows how to run this place. This is his home. He's real good with a hand. You know he is. You're going to have Maggie thinking you don't trust your only child.
Coralie smiled the words, but there was iron and ice just behind them.
Hell yes, he's good with a hand. Good at hunting and fishing and drinking my liquor with him. God knows what he's good at with their gal. He don't even know how big this place is. 10,000 acres, Maggie, of the best goddamn cotton land in the country. What do you think about that? Think you can keep this boy from pissing it all away when I'm gone? Shit, Judge, you'll live to be 103 and I'll have to beat your liver to death with 2x4s that.
Booth drawled comfortably. He gave his father an ingratiating grin. Courtney laughed, and the thin wire of tension snapped.
Well, that's God's truth, he said. One thing this boy did get from me was a good head for liquor. What time did we go to bed this morning anyway, you remember? I cashed in at 5:30, Judge. You were still putting them away when I left.
Where did y'all go this morning? Maggie and I missed you, said Coralie,
seizing on the slackening of the wire and changing the subject.
Went over to the mill at Stoneville. Tom Cunningham's got his ass in a sling again. Always something.
Discontent was crawling back into his voice. Maggie met Hoyt Cunningham this summer, Judge. Boots offered hastily.
You remember Hoyt? He's a reporter now, went to Harvard and everything. Maggie was real taken with him.
With 6 words, he threw her to the lions.
Well, hell yes, I remember Hoyt. It was me that got him that loan to go to school. What do you think? Harvard, huh? Bright boy, if I remember right. I always like to hear when a Delta boy does good.
He slid a pale dagger of a look sideways at Boots.
He gonna work on the Greenville paper?
Ask Maggie. She's the one that knows, said Boots sullenly, stung as he was meant to be by the sideways look. 3 pairs of Claiborne eyes turned to Maggie.
Is Hoyt a friend of yours, Maggie? We've known his family, for years.
Coralie's drawl threw the words away, but they hung in the darkening air as if encircled by chalk on a blackboard. They've worked for you for years, you mean, Maggie thought. She said,
Oh, no, I just met him at a place where he was working. He's a reporter for the Associated Press who works out of Atlanta, but he travels all around covering things, whatever his bureau wants him to cover in his territory. He mentioned you all very fondly, but no, I don't really know him.
Then she realized that her words had betrayed her. She knew far more about this son of Courtney Claiborne's mill manager, this boy to whom Courtney Claiborne's largesse had been flung, than she should know about a casual acquaintance. The 3 Claibornes were silent.
Of course, Boots has told me a lot about him, too, she said lamely.
If I recall, you were doing most of the telling, Maggie,
Boots said perversely. His father had stabbed him, and his parents, he knew, were not pleased that his girl would fraternize with Hoyt Cunningham. Meet him, maybe, but it could have, should have, been cut off there. This girl does not know where to draw the line, their silence said. In an eye flicker, Boots had aligned himself with them. Let the bile flow on Maggie now. Spare me, your son. Oh, no, you don't, Maggie thought in a sudden tight fury.
Well, we did talk for a long time. I found him fascinating. He has such advanced ideas for a Southerner. He believes that the Negroes are on the edge of revolution.
that this bus trouble in Montgomery is just the beginning. He says the whole South is going to go up like kindling. He says we've oppressed the Negroes for too long. He called it pure Marxian revolution, with riots and shooting. As a matter of fact, he thought it might begin right here in the Mississippi Delta. Hoyt had not said that, but Maggie, riding the crest of her own momentum, pushed the spear home. I guess he would think that, since this is his home and he knows the Delta so well. Silence rang like a bell.
By God, I didn't arrange for that son of a bitch to go to school, to go all over the South talking shit!
Courtney Claiborne roared.
That motherfucker better not come back around here spreading that shit. I'll run him out of Greenville. After he took my money, after all I done for his folks, oppressed! Goddamn, there ain't nobody on this river that treats his niggas better than me.
He paused to swallow the rest of his drink. Coralie hissed into the reverberating silence.
Caught! I will not have that kind of language under this roof. Now you hush. What if Cleveland heard you?
I don't give a shit. Cleveland knows there ain't nobody that treats. Cleveland! Come on out here!
Oh, dear God, thought Maggie in pain. Please, I don't want to hear this. Please don't do this. She was silent, the flush staining her neck and cheeks. Cleveland materialized in the clotting dusk at Courtney Claiborne's side.
Cleveland, you heard anything about riots and revolution and shit among the hands?
No, sir.
You got any ideas about revolting and shooting and shit?
Lord God, Miss Court, no, sir.
No, by God, because I treat you too goddamn good, ain't that right?
Yes, sir. You treat us all good, Miss Court, yes, sir.
Goddamn right I do. All right, you can go, Cleveland. Yes, sir.
I hope you're happy, Courtney,
Coralie said in a furious whisper.
That scene will go through the help like a shot through a goose.
Just wanted Miss Maggie here to know how things really stand in Mississippi,
he said in a parody of his normal voice. He was breathing heavily.
Just wanted to know I treat my help good, no matter what Cunningham snot-nosed kid says.
Maggie realized he was very, very drunk. Her anger drained away and fear flooded into its place. She must placate, erase, repair. She would die in the chaos of disapproval.
Boots said you did, Judge Claiborne,
she quavered. Tears were threatening to burst past the walnut-sized lump in her throat.
I can tell you do. I think he's crazy myself, really crazy. I didn't mean I agreed with him. I can't stand him. I'm really sorry if you thought...
She could talk no more without weeping, so she was silent. I'm sorry, Hoyt, she thought. Two of us got sold down the river tonight, and the thought so surprised her that the tears withdrew. But the terrible fear remained, a fear of things broken past repair.
Shit, Maggie. The judge don't mean half he says. He ain't mad at you,
Boots said, but he was looking at his father. She had never heard him speak ungrammatically before.
Of course not, honey. Shoot, he's all the time bellowing around here like a bull. Court, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. What on earth is Maggie going to think of us all?
Coralie, too, rushed to smooth and placate. But Maggie did not miss the shoals of satisfaction deep in the words.
You don't want to take me too serious, sugar,
Courtney Claiborne mumbled.
Not your fault. Sorry. Let's all have another drink.
Boots uncoiled fluidly from his chair.
We got to get on to the Carmichaels, Judge, he said. We're running late. I'll have a snort with you if you're still up when we get home, though.
He caught Maggie by the hand and pulled her from the veranda toward the stable, where the jaguar rested in a cave of darkness. He was ever so slightly unsteady on his feet. Courtney and Coralie sat still in the now thick dark, silhouetted against the faint glow from inside the house. The goodbyes they called were hearty and false and blurred. Maggie, crunching in the gravel behind Boots toward the car, felt nothing at all. They would, she knew, have a fight. They didn't, though. Boots was silent until he turned the jaguar out of the long driveway onto the river road. A mile or so away, he reached over and pulled Maggie against his shoulder. Maggie stiffened. She had expected, at best, a long spell of sullenness, and at worst, a cold, killing final argument. He chuckles low in his throat. Boots, the lazy big cat, was back.
Damned if you didn't rile the judge. I haven't seen him so steamed up since he had to come over to Leland to get me and J.C. Morris out of jail in the middle of the night. Goddamn, Maggie, you almost had me believing you're some kind of nigger lover. I thank you kindly, ma'am, for getting the old man off my ass.
Is that why you think I said that?
Well, wasn't it? You're sure no radical.
Boots, I don't think you have any idea what I am, really.
You're my woman, woman, that's what you are. What else do I need to know about you? Except maybe what you got on under all those petticoats? Hell, you may be right, though. I never knew you had that spitfire streak in you. That was really something, Miss Maggie. You chewing out the old man because he was riding me.
Boots, I'm sorry I said all that. I don't really know what got into me. I've never done anything like that. It was really awful. Mother and Daddy would die if they knew I... But I was just so mad at all of you. Your folks don't think I'm good enough for you, and your daddy was sitting there picking you apart practically, and you just let him, and then you just turned on me with all that stuff about Hoyt Cunningham when you know I don't even like him. You were just trying to get on your daddy's good side and make me look like a fool, and you did. I just plain crawled in front of your daddy. I wish I hadn't even come.
Boots pulled her head down to his shoulder and settled her more comfortably against him. The gear shift bit into her ribs, but she didn't pull away. Obviously, he wasn't going to get angry. Had he really thought she was defending him, though? Couldn't he feel the currents of Coralie's contempt and Courtney's sly familiarity in the very air of the veranda? Maybe I'm being way too sensitive, she thought. I don't know what is the matter with me this summer, but the currents, she knew, had been there. In a rare flash of insight, he picked up her thoughts.
Don't worry about Mother, he said. She doesn't think anybody's good enough for her only baby. Hell, she's done her best to bust up everything I've ever had going in the Delta. When she gets it through her head this is different from the others, she'll settle down. The worst thing you've got against you is that you're not from the Delta, and she'll forget about that before you know it. Now, the old man, he may yell a little, but he likes gumption in a woman. Mother leads him around by the nose, but she's too smart to let him know she does it. He knows damn well you didn't mean any of that nigger shit. He knows you were just sticking up for me. You're going to be just fine on the Delta, baby.
He was pleased with the rout of his father. They had never talked so closely around the subject of marriage. Maybe we won't ever, Maggie thought. Maybe it's just a foregone conclusion, and there will be. World without end, amen.
How far is it to Snooky's? She asked.
I don't feel like going to Snooky's right yet, he said. I'm going to take you downtown to meet Otis before he goes on duty. He's always at the Green Lantern about now.
Who's Otis?
Said Maggie, grateful for the deliverance from the barbecue, grateful that he was not angry, grateful that perhaps she had broken nothing after all.
What kind of duty?
Otis Tanner. You know that friend of mine that's a deputy at the jail. I told you about Otis. Hell, we grew up together. We've raised more hell on this Delta than the James boys. Old Otis never had any money, but he sure can drink liquor and shoot a gun and appreciate a good-looking woman. You'll knock his eyes out. I'll have to defend your honor.
The Greenville jail stood on one of four streets enclosing a shaggy green square, occupied by a two-story white brick courthouse with four stolid, peeling white columns. They went into the Green Lantern Cafe next door to the jail. Maggie blinked in the sudden white light. The long, narrow room had booths along its window wall, looking over the sidewalk and cars at the curb to the black bulk of the courthouse. Music blared from the jukebox. Smoke hung in still, backlit strata. Tables and chairs jammed closely together were dimly visible. Men's eyes turned from each other's faces or lifted from their plates and settled over Maggie. She was the only woman in the Green Lantern. A very fat man sat on a stool behind a cash register.
"Evening, buddy," Boots said to the fat man. "Otis around?"
The rough masculine edge was back in his voice.
"Hey, Boots, heard you was home. Otis is in the back."
The fat man, older by two decades than Boots, spoke with the mingled deference and indulgence a powerful minister might accord an adolescent monarch. He looked at Maggie, a long, full look, but he did not speak. Boots did not introduce her. Otis was alone at a table in the corner of the dark room. He was drinking bourbon. His teeth flashed white in the smoky darkness when he saw Boots, and he stood up. Maggie stared. He was the biggest man she had ever seen. He and Boots knuckled each other on their biceps, grinning.
"God damn, if you ain't still growing, Otis," Boots said. "They're gonna have to get you a convertible squad car if you don't slow down some."
"And you're still chasing women, I see,"
Otis said. He had a rather thin, reedy voice that was disconcerting in one so large.
"Got you a real doll now, ain't you? A genuine imported Georgia peach, I hear. Them river girls of yours ain't gonna like that, Boots."
He gave Maggie a slow, feral, white grimace and looked her ostentatiously up and down.
"Yes, sir,"
he said.
"She's something, Boots. You better keep an eye on her."
"This is Maggie Deloche, Otis," Boots said. "Maggie, Otis Tanner. Didn't I tell you he was the worst bird dog on the Delta?"
"How do you do, Otis?" Maggie said. "Boots has told me a lot about you." The words, so integral and proper a part of the grave, semi-flirtatious ritual of meeting back in Lytton, in Randolph, were absurd in this room that smelled of sweat and smoke and maleness. Absurd, said to the swarthy giant who reeked of them.
"Well, you just sit right down here, Miss Maggie Deloche, and I'll tell you all about old Boots. Maybe when I'm through, you'll shy clean away from him and let me show you around town a little, huh? This boy's been a bad one ever since he could walk. Got too goddamn much money and not enough sense. I sure don't know what you see in this boy, Maggie."
He laughed hugely and poured himself another drink from the bottle that sat on the table. Boots laughed, too.
"Lay off, you son of a bitch," he said. "Give us a drink of that and keep your hands on the table. Mag has had enough trouble tonight. She's already jumped on the judge and told him off, and I figure that's enough for one day."
He launched into the retelling of the sad, vicious little scene on the Claiborne veranda, embroidering here, editing there, making a gay and adventurous business of it. The incident would be told and retold, Maggie knew, passed among the ranks until it became legend. The men of the Delta did not like Courtney Claiborne, she realized, though they feared his money and tolerated his sly, sidewise arrogance. It will never occur to them I might have been serious. But then I wasn't. Was I? Well, of course I wasn't. Otis loved the story. He reared his huge frame back in his chair, laughing until tears glittered in the opaque eyes. Maggie sat silently, smoking Pall Malls, listening to Hank Williams wail "Your Cheatin' Heart" on the Wurlitzer. "I feel like one of those figures in a snowstorm inside a paperweight," she thought tranquilly. "None of this can touch me if I don't want it to. One more night, and then tomorrow we can go back to school. I can wash my hair and put on my pajamas and read. I can sort this out."
"Well, I got to get on back," said Otis. "Come on, y'all walk over with me."
The fat man named Buddy appeared suddenly in the doorway. He was breathing hard.
"Otis!" he squalled. "Thomas Kern said to tell you there's been a break!"
Otis lunged out of his chair, knocking it over, and started for the door. He paused beside the fat man.
"How many of them, Buddy? Which way they gone?" "About 12 of them," Thomas said. "All niggers. Thomas said they ain't on, but they scared, and for you to look sharp."
Otis brushed past him and was gone. The men in the room stirred like a moving sea. There was silence. Into it, the fat man squealed.
"Thomas said for me to tell y'all to stay put and leave it to the police. They ain't gonna get far. The boy's gone right after 'em. They ain't got no guns."
There was a balancing hush. It could go either way in an instant. Maggie clutched her purse in her hand, staring at Buddy. Something witless and primeval and huge walked the room.
"Shit with that. I'm going."
Incredibly, it was Boots' voice. Maggie stared stupidly. He rose, rocking the bottle and glasses on the table. In second, all the men were on their feet, moving in an undulating mass toward the door. She was on her feet, rooted to the floor, her hands clenched into fists.
"No, Boots! No, no, no! Boots! No, no, no!"
"Is that me?" said one part of her mind. "What an ugly voice I have. This is really embarrassing. I never scream. I wish that voice would stop, but it didn't. Not until the room was empty." She walked slowly and stiffly into the front room of the Green Lantern. Maggie walked up to the counter.
"What will happen?"
she said simply.
"Clean forgot you were back there, ma'am," he said. "Don't you worry none. It's just a few niggers run off from the jail. The boy's going to have them back in two shakes of sheep's tail. They ain't got guns."
At the word, the shallow pops flowered into significance in Maggie's mind.
"But that was gunfire. It was, wasn't it? Out back just a minute ago? Oh, God, Boots is out there. I've got to call his daddy."
Another glissando of pops tore the heavy dark. Maggie stared wordlessly at the fat man, then spun and ran out of the cafe. Maggie stood still on the sidewalk in the hot, thick emptiness. Her head was roaring with blood. Her heart was jolting her ribs. She could feel every blow, and she could not get her breath. A serene, incredibly sweet odor of honeysuckle, heavier than the air, curled past her nose from the courthouse square. There was a scuffle of feet in the alley on the other side of the jail. Coarse breath, sobbing, grunts, and a dragging sound as of something heavy, a dead weight. And they were there. They rounded the corner from the alley onto the sidewalk in front of Maggie. Boots and Otis, and between them, arms fastened behind him with handcuffs, stumbling with the force of their dragging arms, a black man, in shapeless gray pants and a torn gray shirt pulled loose from the pants. All three of them stopped. The Negro was small and squat, shorter by half a head than Boots, a head than Otis. His napped head drooped to his chest heaved with deep, tearing breaths. He was very black, shining, almost blue-black under the streetlight, running with perspiration. He did not raise his head or move. None of them moved. Boots and Otis stared across the cracked pavement at Maggie, breathing hard. Boots' yellow hair was darkened with sweat, his lips pulled back from his teeth, breath whistling through his nose. Otis wore the wild dog's grin.
"Got the last black son of a bitch," he said.
The Negro raised his head and looked full into Maggie's face. His face was closed and still, but his eyes were alive. The whites were oddly yellow, veined with red. They held hers. Across 6 feet of heavy, swimming delta air, Maggie read pure, naked fear. And dull hate, and something else. She read as if it were limned on the air a humble desire to please, to placate, to avoid punishment from the two captors who held him. "Please," said the eyes through hate, "I will do anything." In a dome of still, vibrating shock, Maggie thought very clearly and precisely, "That's me."
"I didn't know where you were,"
she said mildly to Boots. And then the gritty, mica-speckled sidewalk swam and surged and slammed up into her cheek. The next weekend, on a Saturday night, Maggie sat in a canvas butterfly chair on the terrace of Ben Flournoy's house, sipping at a strange, colorless liquid that tasted of licorice and listening to Mozart's Requiem and a rhythmic flow of talk. Ben Flournoy had poured out her drinks and wine matter-of-factly, as if there were nothing amiss in a faculty member plying a co-ed with liquor. Indeed, he treated her not as a co-ed, but as any guest who might come to dinner and sit long on his shadowed terrace, listening to his music and sharing his small, exotic house. He had not, as he did in his class, teased her during the evening, but he offered her no careful, grave conversation designed to draw her into the circle of talk either. His glinting malice was diffused and affable, and it gathered the people on the terrace into a warm and favored coterie who looked with amusement and faint elevation out into a less favored world. Maggie was charmed. Kitta Flournoy, small and dark and not pretty, but vividly lovely, sat on a canvas hassock at her husband's feet. Aiken and Tuck sat side by side. Their joined hands swung between them, and Aiken's long, bare foot kneaded Tuck's tennis sock back and forth, back and forth. Aiken was the reason Maggie was there, smelling alienation and confusion and the strangeness around Maggie like a vapor when they had met for their poetry class. The Monday after Maggie had returned from Mississippi, Aiken had pried the story of the weekend from her over lunch. Maggie had been miserable and stunned, and Aiken quiet and noncommittal. "What happened after that?" she said when Maggie told her she had fainted on the sidewalk in front of the jail.
"Nothing, really," Maggie said. "Boots took me home, and Mrs. Claiborne put me to bed."
I don't remember much of it. Boots and his daddy went back down to the jail. It must have been 4 in the morning when I heard them come in. And the next day, Boots and his daddy treated me like a china doll or something, bringing me things and making me stay in bed till lunchtime. It was like I was a heroine, somebody out of Gone with the Wind. It was like they approved of me fainting on the street like that, in front of the whole damn police force. I was so embarrassed, Aiken, I've never fainted in my life.
Well, the vapors are supposed to be very popular in Mississippi, aren't they?
Aiken was amused. It was more than that. It was like they didn't know who or what I was until I pulled that stupid feint. It was like that one thing turned me back into somebody they could, you know, deal with, or something they could pet like a dog or a cat. I felt so funny all weekend, like I was in another country, not even the South. The house is monstrous. I had no idea how big their place was, and all those Negro servants, and so much money. And Boots was like somebody I never met before. I wish you could have seen him after they caught the Negro. You'd think he put down an insurrection or something all by himself. And his daddy was carrying on like Boots had just saved dear old Groland from the Yankees. But the Negro didn't even have a gun. He was about half as tall as Boots and Otis. You know, I had the funniest feeling when I stood there looking at the Negro. I felt like I was looking at myself. Aiken gave her a long, pure gray look.
How do you mean?
Well, like, he was something in a trap and he couldn't get out. He hated the people who trapped him, but at the same time he'd do anything on earth they wanted him to, just so they wouldn't punish him. And I recognized that. I knew what he was feeling.
She gave Aiken an embarrassed smile. Of course, that's silly. It was just nerves, and I'd had a rotten day. But there's still something wrong and strange about that place. Or, she laughed uncertainly, about me.
I think it is you.
Not the way you think, Maggie.
Aiken's eyes forced Maggie's to look at her.
But you are different. You're different from any other Southern girl I've met. You're sure as hell different from Boots Claiborne. Only you've tried so hard for so long to be just like everybody else, all of them, that you don't even know you're different.
I don't know who made your rules for you, Maggie, but they're the wrong rules. You ought to quit being Miss Maggie Deloche and go on and be Maggie. Make your own rules, or find some better ones. It's a fabulous way to live, believe me, I know.
Aiken, I don't even know how to start.
Maggie was near tears.
I guess I realized this weekend that I don't really fit in at Groveland. I don't even really know Boots. All the way back home, he was crowing about catching that Negro and how cute and sweet I was with his friends, and how much his folks are going to love me once they really got to know me. And all I could think was, I want that house. I want that money. But I don't know if I want you, the boy I'm pinned to, Aiken. When I got back to the house, I threw up for an hour. I'm sure Sister thinks I'm pregnant, but it's all so perfect. It's what Mother and Daddy have always...
She broke off.
I'll bet it is, Aiken said.
Then, if not that, what would I do?
Listen, Maggie, I was serious when I said come go home with me after graduation. We'll...
Oh, go to Europe. You said your folks wanted to send you for a graduation present, didn't you?
Well, why not go with me instead of some tacky tour out of Birmingham? Or we could go on to graduate school in the East somewhere. Or we might get jobs in New York and share an apartment. There are a million fabulous things we could do out in the real world. But I know you've got to get out of here, Maggie. If you stay, the best thing that can happen to you is you'll live your whole life in some place that's wrong for you, with some guy who's wrong for you. You'll never find out who you are, and you'll wonder for the rest of your life what went wrong.
Aiken's face was flushed, and she spoke with a passion Maggie had not known was there.
But Boots, I have no idea what Mother and Daddy would say if I just left home and went away. I just don't think...
That's right, Aiken snapped. She was close to being angry. You don't think, and you don't feel. You just walk through life like something on a track, a toy train. Are you afraid for your reputation if you come with me, Maggie? Do you think I'm immoral?
No, Maggie smiled. I guess I've always thought you were more moral than the rest of us.
If I thought about it at all. Aiken picked up her check and her books and her purse. Some subtle point had been made, some score settled.
Keep it in mind, that's all I ask. You don't have to decide anything for a long time. What you need is to see some real people for a change. Tuck and I are going over to the Flournoys for dinner this weekend. Why don't you shed boots and come with us? You'd love Keita Flournoy, and you know Ben adores you.
I can't do that. You can because Tuck's faculty, but I don't have any reason to be there. And they didn't ask me, Aiken.
But on Wednesday night, the phone had rung for Maggie, and Keita Flournoy had said in her light, melony voice that Ben had spoken of her often and fondly, and they would be so happy if Maggie would come and have dinner with them.
I'd love to come, Maggie had said.
Through drinks and dinner, and through half of the curly carafe of wine, the conversation had been vivid but comfortable, lulled, and for the first time since the weekend before, not aching and prickle-skinned, Maggie sat in the quiet dark and listened to the music. She closed her eyes. Perhaps she slept.
Up to the writers of the South to take a stand. The literary mind is the last voice of conscience crying in the wilderness. In the last analysis, the torch of integration will be caught up by the writers. The writers will stand with the Negro.
Tuck's voice, slurring badly, reached into Maggie's cocooned consciousness and nagged her back from sleep. She opened her eyes, blinking peevishly. Tuck glowered thoroughly at Ben Flournoy.
Au contraire, said Ben Flournoy, reaching for Maggie's cigarettes. The voice of conscience crying in the wilderness is loudly and busily selling the Negro back down the river. Just last March, I believe, it was Mr. William Faulkner who told a gentleman from the London Sunday Times that he would have none of the government's integration policy. He said if he had to choose between the United States government and Mississippi, he would choose Mississippi.
Maggie can tell you about Mississippi, Aiken said. There was something implacable in her gray eyes. Maggie was in an honest-to-God jailbreak over there last weekend. Your Lady of the Lake was all shook up then.
Tell us about the jailbreak, Princess.
Tuck pounced on her gleefully.
What happened, Maggie?
Ben Flournoy was looking at her. It was a careful, neutral look, and a waiting one.
It wasn't anything. It wasn't much of a jailbreak. It's not even interesting.
It is interesting, Aiken said relentlessly. If you won't tell it, I will.
And Aiken told the story. They were all silent until she had finished, Maggie in mortification and betrayal. They were silent for a moment after. There was a constricted aching in Maggie's chest. The drowsing rightness of the night was gone. She was very much afraid. Something was curling into the half-empty place inside her, forming like smoke into a shape, a substance. She did not know what it was.
I do rather agree with you, Tucker, that men and women of letters just might become the voice of conscience crying in the wilderness, as you so eloquently put it,
Ben Flournoy said lightly and acidly.
Miss Deloche here might, with a great deal of application, be such a voice one day, provided, of course, that she has truly been gifted with one of those blinding divine flashes of insight that are the essence of poetry. How about it, Miss Deloche? Now that you have seen its fearsome face in the heart of darkest Mississippi, do you think you're ready to throw yourself upon the barricades of racial injustice? Declare yourself.
He peered glitteringly at Maggie. She stared back. Through the coiling smoke in her head, she saw the dead white moons of streetlights on an empty Mississippi street, the tree-trunk bodies of two tall, grinning young white men, and the powerful slack shell of a black man pinned between them. She saw the open eyes again. I hate, they said. I am afraid, they said. I will obey, they said. I know, she said in her own mind.
I have to go back to the house now, she said.
In a soft rush of goodbye come again, they saw her to the door. Ben Flournoy stood looking after her as she walked to her Plymouth. When she had driven away, he turned to Keita Flournoy, who stood beside him, her arm encircling his waist. He rested his chin on the top of her head.
I'm terribly afraid of doing a wrong thing, he said.
You are never wrong, Ben, she said. Back at the Kappa house, Maggie showered and put on shorty pajamas. In her mirror, her face was pale and her eyes vivid and enormous. I look pretty tonight. What a waste of pretty this night is. I want something, she thought. What? I want everything to stay just like this, but I want it to be tomorrow, too.
Maggie? Is that you out there? Come up here this minute. Sister did it. Sister's pinned, roared M.A.
Sister is pinned? Sister looked at Maggie. A gold diamond-shaped shield was pinned beneath her kappa pin.
I did it, Maggie.
Oh, sister.
Well, aren't you going to congratulate me?
A powerful surge of something hurting and splitting began behind Maggie's ribs. She held out her arms and Sister ran into them.
Oh, sister, oh, sister, oh, sister, Maggie sobbed. She wept hard. Oh, sister, oh, poor baby.
The Kappa smiled indulgently and fondly at Maggie, crying. They thought she wept with joy. In the morning, Maggie cut her first class. After the house had emptied of girls, she pulled her birthday present royal portable from underneath her bed and set it up on the green metal desk she shared with Sister. She stared for a very long time at nothing at all, and then she began to type. Last weekend in Mississippi, I met a man I will never forget, she wrote, even though I do not know his name. She typed steadily for perhaps half an hour, not stopping to correct mistakes, and then she typed 30 and pulled the last page out of her typewriter and put it with the rest and anchored the pages under her purse and went into the bathroom to take a shower. Maggie climbed the back stairs to the second floor of the Student Union building. There, down a long corridor, was the office of the student newspaper. Maggie stood for a long moment outside the door and then went in. At a desk surrounded by metal file cabinets, an extremely fat boy sat pecking at a typewriter. He was blonde, more than blonde, bleached. He wore colorless plastic-rimmed glasses. Terry Bevins had been editor of the Randolph Senator for 2 years running, an unprecedented tenure. A Phi Delta Theta legacy from a wealthy Mobile family, he had been pledged only under great alumni pressure. But his elfin wit and firefly mind, a natural sweetness, had won his brothers and catapulted him to vast popularity among the student body. At the Senator, he had found his niche. He was a natural and awesomely gifted editor, and during his time there, the perfunctory little paper took on a layer of glistening advertising fat and a briskly professional look. Maggie was at home with him, and he was with her, recognizing, as Ben Flournoy did, some unmeasured submerged gift, and needling her gently to apply it to weightier matters than she generally did. Like Aiken, he walked often alone and without censure. He was engaged to a sweet-faced brown sparrow of an independent girl in home economics. She wore both his pin and a flinty chip of a diamond engagement ring. He looked up at Maggie and smiled.
2 days late, Deloche, he said. Don't tell me there's nothing worth writing about over there. How's Delia, by the way?
She's better in one way. Her bandages will come off this weekend, and she can probably go home pretty soon after that. The first plastic surgery is scheduled for September, but she just lies there. She'll answer questions, but she won't talk. She'll never look the same. The doctor said she could come back to school winter quarter if she wants to, but her mother says she won't even discuss it. She just lies there.
Mrs. Jenks, I guess.
We all miss Jenks.
Well, what you got for me?
Maggie took the folded sheets of paper from her purse and handed them to him. He tossed them into his overflowing inn basket and swiveled back to his typewriter. Maggie did not move to go.
I think you better read it, Terry.
For a long time there was only the sound of pages turning. Then he shuffled them and he looked up at her. Maggie, I can't run that, he said.
Why not?
It's inflammatory. You know as well as I do how the Publications Board feels about this kind of stuff. The senator can't speak out for integration, not publicly, no matter how any of us feels about it. The Board of Regents would go crazy. It's not the senator speaking out, Terry. It's me, just one person, and it's just my opinion. And I certainly don't feel like it's inflammatory. Not to you, and not to me, and certainly not in the free press out in the world. But, Maggie, I got a good bit of shit over that harmless authorine Lucy piece you did. Randolph never had a Negro student. God knows what would happen if a Negro applied here. I'm only urging reason and empathy for Negroes. I only said that to live honorably with them, we have to understand them, get into their skins, so that when integration does come, there won't be, well, violence, shooting, and things. Well, nobody at Randolph is all that anxious to get inside a Negro skin, Maggie. Least of all the Publications Board. Least of all the Board of Regents. I want you to run that column, Terry. Maggie, I'd get kicked off the Senator staff, and so would you. What if you printed a disclaimer saying this was my own personal opinion and the senator wasn't responsible for it? He looked at her again silently. What a pretty girl she is, he thought. I never knew she had this kind of passion. I'll do this, he said slowly. I'll take it before the Publications Board next Monday night. I'll tell them you're willing to run it under a disclaimer. That's the best I can do, Maggie. Will you stick up for it, Terry? I honestly don't know, Maggie, he said, but I'll take it over there. Thank you, Terry. You'll let me know. You'll know, Maggie. I guarantee you, you'll know. She walked out of the office. He rose and squeezed himself from behind the crowded desk and stood in the doorway watching her go. Watch out, Maggie, he said aloud but very softly. On the following Sunday night at 9 o'clock, M.A. Appleton neighed up the cap of stairs. Maggie, you got a visitor! Maggie clocked down the stairs to the living room. Aiken Reed stood alone in the dimly lit big room, her back to Maggie. Aiken, hey! Maggie said, surprised. Aiken turned, giving Maggie her slow smile. I thought you might like to drive out to Dairyland and get something cold to drink, she said. I have something to tell you. What? It's a surprise. Aiken, is it about you and Tuck? In a way. Will you come? Well, sure. Just let me throw on some shorts. They got into the MG and drove across the silent campus in the heavy, moonless dark. They smoked in silence until they reached Dairyland. They ordered limeades. Well, tell, said Maggie, smiling. I'm pregnant, Aiken said. Maggie stared at her. Shock thrummed in the air around her. Aiken might have just said she had murdered someone. Pregnancy had never entered Maggie's mind in connection with Aiken. What are you going to do? She said. I mean, I know y'all get married, but when will the baby, how far along are you? Only 2 months, Aiken said dreamily. I wanted to tell you tonight because I'm leaving school tomorrow. I wanted to say goodbye to you. You've been a good friend to me, Maggie, and I'll miss you very much. Leaving? Oh, no, Aiken, you don't have to leave. Tuck will... Aiken, has that son of a bitch refused to marry you? Tuck doesn't know. Well, tell him, for God's sake. Aiken, you can't seriously be afraid to tell Tuck you're pregnant. He's crazy about you. He'll marry you tonight if you want him to. Maggie, I don't want to marry Tuck. I'm going to have my baby. I've always wanted a baby. It's just that I've never wanted to be married very much. I've never met a man I wanted to be with for the rest of my life. I've been with Tuck, and I guess you might say I loved him in a way, but not for the rest of my life. There's something important, I don't know what it is, that I need to do with my life. Something somewhere that I haven't found yet. I'm just starting, Maggie. Whatever it is could be out there anywhere. I could find it any time. But not here, not in Randolph and some little house full of diapers and a mortgage and a set of plastic dishes. Maybe what I'm looking for is a man, but not any man I've ever met yet. And I don't think it is a man anyway. It's more something that I will do myself, something sort of great. I've always thought that I will be a great woman one day. I'm going to New York. I'd wait until the quarter ended, but there just doesn't seem to be any sense in that, and I just don't want to have to play out any silly charades with Tuck. Besides, I'll be showing by then, thin as I am. I have some money that my grandmother left me in trust. I got it when I was 21, and I haven't touched a penny of it. There's more than enough until the baby comes, and I'll be working anyway. My Aunt Deirdre, my mother's younger sister, has a fabulous job with an interiors firm in the village. They do just the kinds of things I love, and Deirdre will get me a job there. I've already talked to her. I called her the day before yesterday. They need somebody.
Oh, Aiken, was she terribly upset?
She loved it, Maggie. Deirdre is our family rebel, or was till I came along. She doesn't give a damn about what anybody thinks about her. I've always adored her, and she's always said I was just like her own child, although she's just 11 years older than me. Mother never got along with her. They all think she's, oh, I don't know, bohemian and awful. She's been living with an artist in the village for years now, a very talented man. She could marry him, I guess, but they just don't want to get married. She doesn't need the money. She makes a fortune at her job, and she's sure she can get me on starting in September.
But you'll be 4 months along then. You'll be showing.
Maggie, they don't care about that in New York. I'm good enough now. I don't need a degree. I can stay with Deirdre until early spring because Paul will be in Germany till at least then. I'll be there when the baby comes, and then Deirdre says she'll help me find an apartment in the village. She says they have wonderful daycare center things in the village. It's sort of a new idea, and I'll just live and work and raise my baby. It's all worked out. You mustn't worry about me.
Are you going to tell Tuck at all? I mean, what are you going to tell him? You can't just up and leave him without a word, Aiken.
That's just what I'm going to do. He'll come to you first thing when he knows I'm gone, and I don't want you to tell him where I am or that I'm pregnant or anything. Please, Maggie. I'll call him once I'm settled, and I'll tell him about the baby. Maggie, I'll write you. I don't want to lose you, but you mustn't tell Tuck.
All right, Aiken. But aren't you afraid at all? Just a little?
No, I never felt more exhilarated in all my life. I only wish you'd stop crying. She cried, and Aiken held her. Finally, she raised her head and managed a weak, watery smile. I should be comforting you. Not necessary, but I'll tell you what you can do if you like.
What?
Come over in the morning about 11 and help me load the car. The next morning, Maggie drove the Plymouth over to the Pi Beta Phi house. They made several trips down the stairs from Aiken's room. They fitted the remaining things into the cramped back seat of the MG. Aiken swung into the car and shut the door. Bye for now, Maggie. I'll write you as soon as I get there, and I'll see you next June. It was not a question. Time to get this show on the road, said Aiken, and she released the clutch and slid the MG onto the quiet street. The NG turned the corner and buzzed out of sight. Maggie stood listening to its cheerful, winding cricket burr until it faded and was gone. Then she got into the Plymouth and drove back to the Kappa house. It was noon. It would be the first time that summer she had eaten there. Tuck called Maggie late in the afternoon of the same day. Where is Aiken? He had not even said hello.
Tuck, I don't know. She did say something about a cousin getting married soon.
Did you see her in Flournoy's class this morning?
I didn't go. I had a history paper due, and I had to finish it.
Maggie, if you know where she is, for God's sake, tell me. This is more than I can stand.
I don't know, Tuck.
Maggie, if you hear from her, if she calls you, please.
I will, Tuck.
He hung up. The next morning, in her poetry class, Flournoy cocked an avian eye at Maggie. Miss Reed has apparently decided not to join us again today, I see, he said. Maggie had planned to tell him about Aiken after class. Instead, she looked directly into his face and said,
I think she's gone to a wedding, Dr. Flournoy.
Ah, a pity. I seem to recall she has taken all her cuts. I should hate to penalize her for something so plebeian as an Upper Montclair mating right. Maggie did not tell him the next day or the next. She felt obscurely that to do so would set some irreversible force in motion. She spent an evening with Boots at the movie theater watching a rerun of Brigadoon. And the next evening they went with a group of K.A.'s and their dates to the lake to cook hamburgers. They were not alone either evening, and she pleaded studying, and he brought her home early both nights. Flournoy did not mention Aiken again during those 2 days. On Friday, at the end of class, he said, "Miss Deloche, have you a moment to spare? I'd like to see you in my office." "Yes, sir," she said. Ben Flournoy sat behind an elephantine, scarred roll-top desk that swam in a surf of papers and dwarfed the small room. Books were everywhere. "The Publications Board met Monday night," he said abruptly. "You knew that, of course?" She nodded. "That young chap from the student newspaper, Bevins, a good man, Maggie, put an extremely interesting item before the board. He did so, I might say, with considerable passion." He looked at her as if expecting some comment, but she made none. She had thought that he would ask her about Aiken. She had almost forgotten the column and was momentarily disoriented. "It was quite a remarkable bit of writing, Maggie. I knew, of course, that you had a felicity for words. I did not know you had courage. It is a moving, open, honest piece of journalism, and I am pleased to tell you that it will appear in the Senator."
"I'm very grateful to you, Dr. Flournoy."
"It's a very grave responsibility, Maggie." Flournoy was somber. "For you and for me."
"I really do thank you for telling me, Dr. Flournoy, and for sticking up for my column."
He looked back at her. "Maggie, where is Aiken Reed?" She paused, staring back at him, and then she sat down again, and she told him. "That is some lady," he said. "That is some lady indeed." When Maggie got back to the Kappa house, the upstairs phone was ringing. She picked it up.
"Is Maggie Deloche there? Terry?"
"Oh, hi, Maggie. Listen, your column's going to run next Friday. Congratulations, good luck, and batten down for heavy seas."
"I know, Terry. Dr. Flournoy told me. I want to thank you."
"Shucks, 'twarn't nothing. Bye." He was gone. Maggie went into her room and shucked off the damp clothes, leaving them in a heap on the floor. She walked naked into the bathroom and peered at herself in the mirror. There were circles under her eyes, giving her a frail, rapt, intense look. "Margaret Hamilton Deloche, girl integrationist," she said to her face in the mirror. For the first time since Aiken had left, she laughed out loud. 3 days before the Senator, with Maggie's column in it, was to come out on campus, Booth's grandfather died in Leland, Mississippi. Booth called her at 8:30 in the morning.
"I'll have to go home," he said petulantly. "I'm going to leave about 10. I'll be back this weekend. There's a party at the house Saturday night I don't want to miss. Probably the last one we'll have this summer. We're going to have a combo from Mobile."
"I wish you could get back Friday."
"What's so special about Friday?"
"Nothing, really. I'll just miss you."
There's not going to be anybody here for me when the paper comes out, she thought, and realized she was a little afraid. He was pleased.
"Good. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, they say. Maybe it'll make the bod grow fonder, too. I'll see you Saturday, babe."
The Randolph Senator was put into metal boxes around the campus at noon on Friday. When Maggie left her poetry class on that Friday, her heart was beating in her throat. "I don't know what I think is going to happen," she thought. "Riots on campus when I walk out of here?" At lunch, no one mentioned the column. Maggie was relieved and obscurely disappointed. After lunch, she did not drift over to the student union to see who was there, as she had every afternoon during the heat wave. She went upstairs and washed her hair and began a manicure. She was nerved up and restless. At 2 o'clock, M.A. Appleton and Jean Lockridge appeared in her doorway.
They were carrying copies of the senator, and they were not smiling. "Can we talk to you for a minute, Maggie?" Jean said formally. On any other day, they would simply have walked in. She put down her Cutex natural. "Come on in. I guess you know what this is about."
M.A., looking lugubrious. "One last cigarette before the firing squad comes, my daughter," Maggie thought in fierce defensive annoyance. "If she says she'll pray for me, I'll spit in her eye."
"I guess I do indeed, M.A., she said. "Maggie, how could you do a thing like this? Didn't it occur to you how this would make us look on campus? Every other sorority is going to just love it. They'll probably read it to every rushie that comes through Fall Rush."
"Oh, shit, M.A. Maggie was really angry. "I haven't broken any rules. I wasn't even talking about anything but a personal experience I had. You act like I was 7 months pregnant and got caught having a drunken orgy in the First Methodist Church. None of you care a good goddamn about anything but what a bunch of stupid little college boys think about you. Don't you even care what happens to the Negroes? I mean, after a century of being oppressed, they finally got a chance to..." "No!" M.A. roared. "I don't care about the Negroes. I care about this sorority. I care about our reputation. Maggie, you took a sacred oath to be loyal to this sorority. Doesn't that mean anything to you?"
"Well, you'll probably lose Boots' pin," said Jean Lockridge practically. "If Boots wants his pin back over this little piece of paper, then I don't want the damn pin," said Maggie. She was frightened at the passion of their disapproval, and honestly surprised, but most of all, deeply and coldly angry.
"I know who's behind this," Jean said. "Aiken Reed. She's a trashy whore who'd rather make trouble than get out of this room right now. Right this minute. Both of you, or I'll jerk your hair out."
Her face must have been terrible, because they scuttled out of the room. She slammed the door behind them. Then she began to cry with sheer fury and frustration. It helped. In half an hour, she was calm. "Round one," she thought. No one mentioned the column to Maggie at dinner. No one mentioned it during the long evening, either, except Sister, who dashed in briefly to change. Sister was going with Gary to Columbus to ice skate.
"What on earth got into you to do that piece on the Negroes?"
she said from the depths of pale pink cotton. Her voice was muffled but unheeded. Sister saves her passion for more basic, immediate issues.
"Half the house is in M.A.'s room gabbing about it."
"Terry and I are both resigning from the Senator. You might be sure to tell M.A. and that bunch. I'm sure it will make them very happy. Fitting retribution."
"They are pains in the ass, aren't they? Want me to stop by and tell them you resigned?"
"I guess it would be good if you would, Sister. I don't feel like talking to any of them any more tonight."
"Well, I will. Wonder what Boots is going to say."
"I have no idea."
"Nothing, probably. Gary said most of the SAEs thought it was funny. Just one or two of them were kind of grumbling about it."
"I'm going over there for a party tomorrow night with Boots. I'm not scared of the KAs, Sister. They're my friends. Besides, I should think my resigning would calm everybody down. Isn't it just what a lady should do if she's caused a commotion?"
"I think I'll go to bed early. See you in the morning, Sister."
The news of her resignation had, apparently, diffused the situation. No one mentioned the incident until late morning, as Maggie was preparing to go to the dry cleaners.
"I just wanted to tell you that we're proud of you, Maggie," M.A. said, blinking tremulously. "We know you didn't mean what you said. You proved that when you resigned. I don't think it's going to hurt the chapter much at all this way."
Maggie stared after her square, retreating back. She opened her mouth to call after her, then closed it again. People who mattered would understand. And Boots? He thinks my writing is cute. But her stomach knotted. 5 hours till he picked her up for the party at the K.A. house. "I'll tell him about the whole thing when he gets here so we can laugh about it, and he won't walk in cold at the house. I can always make him laugh when I put my mind to it." He was drunk when he picked her up that evening, or near it.
Maggie had never seen him so disheveled. Discontent and discomfort dragged his long mouth down at the corners, and there was something honed and dangerous flicking in his green eyes. "Bad drive?" she asked when he had hugged her perfunctorily. His arms stuck to her bare shoulders.
"Oh, Christ, it gets longer every time I drive it. Come on, I want to get over to the house and under a cold shower as fast as I can. If it wasn't for that combo, I swear to God we'd skip this party and just go out to the lake or something."
She knew that his mood was too dark and precarious for just the heat. "Was it bad, the funeral?"
"It was just a funeral. It wasn't so bad."
"Well, then, what's the matter? Were your folks really upset?"
"Yeah, hell, they were upset all right. Only not about Granddaddy. Cleveland quit. He quit right after that spell the old man had on the patio when we were over there. The old man says it's because you got him so worked up over what Cunningham said that he lost his temper and chewed out Cleveland. And he's blaming me for that."
"Oh, Boots, no."
"Ah, shit, Maggie, he's just worked up right now, taking it out on me. The old man doesn't like to lose his niggers, and he knows he made a jackass out of himself. But I wish to Christ you hadn't said that. It'll take him the rest of the summer to calm down."
"Maybe you'd rather not go to the party," she said in a small voice.
It was not time to tell him about the column, but they were driving straight toward a confrontation with it.
"Nah, I need a drink and I want to have some fun. I'm sick as a dog of hearing about niggers."
"Oh, God, please don't let anybody mention that column till I can talk to him about it," she prayed. "I can fix it in the morning, but please let things just be okay tonight." They drove the rest of the way in silence. The K.A. house glimmered and throbbed with the party. Couples stood talking on the pillared portico, drifted on the front lawn with paper cups in their hands, or disappeared into the open front door to the drawing room, where Maggie knew Mrs. McCleskey would be greeting the brothers' dates.
"Go on back, Maggie. You don't need anybody to go with you, do you?"
"I'll just go say hello to Mother Mad," Maggie said. She took a deep breath and walked into the drawing room. Mrs. McCleskey stood in front of the fireplace, filled now for the summer with her Boston ferns. Three people stood with her. Maggie recognized Dabney Gleason, the new president-elect of the student body, and Sue Ellen Singer. Her heart sank. Sue Ellen, the pretty one, the startling beauty whose place in this house was assured by her face, but who had sought and earned no campus honors. Maggie met her slow smile and knew the face of the enemy. The third figure, a male one, had his back to Maggie.
"Hello, Maggie. Where's the boy?"
Gleason said. And Sue Ellen smirked silkily, and the figure turned. It was Hoyt Cunningham.
"Come here and meet an old friend of Boots from home," Gleason said. "He just got in. I told him any friend of Boots was welcome. This is Maggie Deloche, Hoyt Cunningham, from Greenville, Mississippi. This is Boots' girl, Hoyt."
Maggie stared. She was being rude, she knew, but she was not functioning well. That he should be here in this hostile house was as unimaginable as her mother or father standing before her.
"Well, Maggie, we meet again," he said, grinning at her under the white-ringed eyes.
He looked very tan and rumpled, squarer than she remembered, and older.
"Hey, Hoyt," she said primly. "What on earth are you doing here?"
"I told you I'd drop in on Boots the next time I was in the neighborhood," he said. "I'm on my way over to Montgomery for a couple of weeks, and I thought, well, I'll go see what this famous K.A. hospitality is all about."
"You all have met, I take it."
Sue Ellen's drawl was tossed silver money in the crackling air. Maggie knew viscerally that Sue Ellen had read the column and would mention it, though not perhaps just yet. She would pick her time well.
"Yes,"
said Maggie and Hoyt together. They looked at each other and laughed, Maggie stiltedly, he lazily.
"Maggie and I had occasion to share a cup of coffee one evening when I was through here back at the beginning of the summer," he said. "My old buddy Boots has good taste."
"Surely does,"
Gleason said.
"Maggie keeps things lively around here, doesn't she, Sue Ellen?"
"Oh, you'll hear a lot more about Maggie.
Just you wait," Sue Ellen purred. There was a shimmering silence.
"Maggie's been neglecting her friends for her extracurricular activities."
Sue Ellen dimpled. She took Gleason's arm and floated at his side out the French doors onto the patio, a poisonous butterfly. Hoyt studied Maggie for a moment. "What's going on with those two? Have you been indiscreet with a carpetbagger or something?"
"Nothing's going on."
"Boots will be glad to see you, Hoyt. What will you be doing in Montgomery?"
"I'm not sure. There's a rumor that two Negroes will be enrolling at the Montgomery branch of the university this fall. I'm just going to smell around a little."
"I'm getting awfully tired of the Negroes," Maggie flared. "Every time I turn around this summer, there's another Negro staring me in the face. All of a sudden, they're coming out of the woodwork."
"The woodpile, I think you mean," he said.
"Can this be the girl who single-handedly took on Courtney Claiborne, the Greenville police force, and the folkways and mores of the sovereign state of Mississippi?"
"How in the hell did you know about that?"
"I keep in touch with home," he said briefly.
"Well, come on, Maggie. The wayfarer is thirsty. Shall we join your friends for a little libation? Though with friends like that, you sure as hell don't need enemies."
He held out his arm and she laid her fingers on it lightly. It was warm and rough-skinned and solid. They walked out onto the patio. Maggie stood leaning against the gritty red bricks of the house. She felt gay, rapt, exhilarated, beyond defiance. She had two more cups of punch. Hoyt did not leave Maggie's side. He drank steadily, too, though it did not appear to affect him. Boots was there suddenly at her elbow. He smelled of soap and bourbon, new bourbon, not stale. "He's been drinking upstairs," she thought clearly.
"Hey, Cunningham, I see Maggie's already fixed you up with a drink. You looking for a bed for one or two?"
His voice was too soft, and his eyes were slitted.
"Has he read the column?" Maggie thought. "No, it's not that kind of mad. It's Hoyt. He's heard too much about Hoyt this summer."
Brightly, she said, "Hoyt's on his way to Montgomery, Boots, to cover a story." Couples had begun to move up toward them when Boots had appeared on the patio. They were talking and laughing among themselves as before, but their eyes edged to the three people standing by the punch vat, fell away, edged back.
"What are you going to Montgomery for, Cunningham?" Boots said.
"No, Hoyt," Maggie said under her breath.
"There may be a story about a couple of Negro students enrolling at the university branch over there," Hoyt said. "Could be some trouble."
"Oh, hell yes. If there's a way to have some nigger trouble, there'll be nigger trouble," Boots said thickly. "Sick of nigger talk. Just drove 300 miles to get away from nigger talk. This may be the only place in the goddamn South there ain't any nigger talk."
"Why, Boots, Randolph is the nigger talk capital of the world now, hadn't you heard? Ask Maggie. She's made us famous."
It was Sue Ellen's voice.
"What are you talking about, Sue Ellen?" he said.
"I mean Maggie's column that just came out yesterday. I think it's a shame and a disgrace on this house and on this campus, and I think it's awful that nobody would tell you about it. It's about your hometown."
And she turned and flounced into the crowd and was lost. Boots turned abruptly and lurched through the French doors and disappeared into the house. Hoyt looked at Maggie. "You want to go?" he said.
"No," she said, smiling widely at him. She reached for a Dixie cup and filled it from the tub of tepid punch and drank it down. "I may stay all night. You want to leave? Go ahead. I think it might be a good idea."
"Nope."
He settled himself back against the bricks of the house.
"Think I'll stay for the late show. Looks like a star might be born."
Boots was back before them, a rolled copy of the Senator in his hand. His face was distorted, pulled back as with the force of gravity, white and sweating.
"You just can't keep your mouth shut, can you, Maggie?" he hissed. "Just got to get down there and roll around with the niggers, don't you? Fuck around in the dirt with them. Oh, this is good, Maggie. Oh, yeah, this is real fine stuff."
His voice was rising. Couples stopped dancing and stared. Hoyt was still, rigid. Abruptly, Maggie hiccuped and giggled and clapped her hand over her mouth. "Oops," she said. His hand shot out and pinioned her shoulders. He shook her violently, like a terrier with a snake. Maggie's head snapped back and forth. She could not stop giggling.
You goddamn nigger-loving whore!
It was a high, thin animal squeal.
You two-bit little Judas!
Hoyt's fist caught him under his chin and lifted him off his feet. His head snapped back. He stumbled backward and fell sideways against the punch tub. Hoyt put an arm under Maggie's shoulder and around her waist. Let's get out of here, he said, and half carrying, half dragging her, ran her out to the dark street.
You're always dragging me out of places, she said. Don't you get tired of dragging me out of places?
Be quiet. Move your feet. On the portico, Maggie looked back. She had a clear shot through the house and onto the terrace. She saw Boots on his hands and knees vomiting onto the flagstones. Figures were only just uncoiling from the crowd moving toward him.
Boots just can't hold his liquor,
she said judiciously to Hoyt. And then she slid into darkness like sleep. When she woke up, there was a spattering roar all around her. Hoyt's face swam into view above hers, green pale in the dash lights of the Thunderbird.
Hey, she said, where are we?
Hi, you awake? We are at a motel in Lanette. Outside a motel in Lanette. I decided to abandon my plans for the evening and find a more congenial place to sleep. And I didn't know what to do with you. You passed out colder than a mackerel. So I brought you along for the ride. Sorry I hit your buddy there, but it didn't look like he was going to cool off any time soon. How come I'm always saving your fanny?
You are a hero, Hoyt, you know. My hero. And I don't much think Boots is my buddy anymore.
He took a swallow from a pint of Jack Daniels and passed it to her.
I read your article, he said.
My famous, famous article. Where did you get it?
I picked it up when Claiborne dropped it. Wanted to see what it was that made the shit hit the fan.
What did you think of the great article that started the new Civil War?
The car was spinning. She burrowed her head into Hoyt's shoulder to stop it. He pulled her closer to him.
I thought it was a silly, emotional, simplistic little piece of garbage that sounded like a college girl wrote it.
Maggie sat up and looked at him, widening her eyes to keep him in focus.
Silly? It was not silly. You may be the big expert on the Negro with the capital N, but I met a man. I met a man in Mississippi, and it's tearing up my life, and it's pulling me apart, and that's what's going to happen to you, Hoyt, when you meet a man. A man. You come back and you talk to me about the Negro when you've met a man.
Maggie, Maggie. She began to cry, helplessly at first, the loose, copious tears of drunkenness, and then hard, hurting, shaking sobs that spiraled and soared and tore up from her stomach. He gathered her into his arms and pressed her face into his shoulder. He smoothed her hair and held her and let her cry.
Tell me, baby, he said against her hair. Tell me what happened to you.
And she did, finally, her mouth still pressed into his shoulder. She told him about Delia and Jenks, about the visit to the Delta and the jailbreak, about Flournoy and Aiken and Tuck and the column.
Everything's gone wrong and awful and strange. Everybody I loved has gone. Boots will be gone. That's over.
I'm here, baby. Don't cry. I'm here.
Don't leave me.
I won't leave you, Maggie. Ah, I won't.
He kissed her face softly, her eyes, her hair, her mouth. Blindly, she strained up to him, toward warmth and solidarity and heaviness. He murmured to her. She responded, not knowing what she said, urgency and need swimming over her with his face, which surged in and out of focus. Pure physical sensation was the only thing alive in her. She had never known it could be so powerful. It consumed time and place and dimension. It flooded and drowned her. She drew back, breath rasping, staring intently to bring his face back into clarity. He stared back, his hands tangled and pulling in her hair, his chest laboring.
Let me stay with you tonight.
Maggie, baby, love,
I want to go with you. Now, please, please.
You don't know what you're saying. You don't mean that.
I do know. I do mean it. I want it.
Hoyt, please. Please don't take me back. I want to stay with you.
Are you sure, Maggie?
Are you sure?
I'm sure, she moaned, feeling a great shimmering, nothing-colored void open under her feet. She stepped off into it.
I'm sure.
Come on, then. He opened the door on his side. A darkened motel unit loomed out of the flying darkness beyond the door.
Do you have to check in?
It was someone outside and beyond Maggie talking. I already did, while you were asleep. Nobody knows you're even here. Come on, love, if you're coming.
I'm coming.
They dashed through the rain and inside and shut the door. For just a moment, for a cool, suspended time when she woke, Maggie thought she was at home in her bedroom in Lytton. And then she was abruptly, coldly, finally awake, and she sat up in bed. She was naked under the rough sheet. Hoyt slept in the bed beside her, on his face, one long arm dangling over the side of the bed.
Oh, my God, she said softly.
There was a fine, nearly imperceptible quivering deep inside her, like the whirring of a hummingbird's wings. She moved gently toward the bathroom, pushing aside heavy air. She stood under fitful gusts of very hot water, with her eyes closed. With them closed, she could keep awareness safely at a distance. This is not even going to bother me if I don't let it, she thought, scrubbing dreamily with antiseptic-smelling soap. I don't remember any of it. The black act, the dirty deed, she hummed to herself, and I don't even remember it. A thought pierced her with sudden, still, enormous hope. Maybe we didn't. Wouldn't I know if we did? But then the new pain niggled at her through the hot water, and the hope drained away. But we did, she thought, and the iridescent unreality came flooding back. When she came out of the bathroom, she was awake. Hey, lady, he said, and his voice was hoarse in his throat. Good morning. She did not look at him, but at her clothes. Busily, she gathered them up and took them into the bathroom. When she came back out of the bathroom, he was dressed, except for his shoes. You okay, baby? He said.
Fine.
Maggie?
What?
Are you really okay? Should I be sorry?
Good heavens, whatever for? I'm a consenting adult.
I expect we were both pretty bombed, weren't we? She laughed lightly. Put it off, put it off. Don't look, said the crystal voice in her head. He walked to her, put his hand under her chin, raised her face. I wasn't drunk, he said. I mean, that wasn't why I...
Well, I was. Wow, what a merry little old evening, all told.
She turned her head away from his fingers, shutting her eyes. Maggie... You're not all right, are you?
I'm fine, really. I just want to go.
We're as good as gone, he said. They went quietly from the motel unit and got into the car. He reached for her hand. She let it lie limp in his. This is not a usual thing for me, Maggie, no matter what you think.
I don't think anything.
They drove in silence for a while. She looked over at him, lounging behind the wheel of the car, solid and rumpled and sharply detailed in the morning light. I never really saw you in the daylight, she said. Get used to it, then. You'll be seeing a lot of me in all kinds of light. Can you stand it?
I don't think so,
she said matter-of-factly. He turned his face to hers. The intensity of his eyes swallowed hers. You mean that, Maggie? You want me to get lost?
I think so, yes.
Why? Are you ashamed of last night? Or didn't it mean anything to you? You worried about boots?
No, I'm not worried about boots anymore. I just don't think there's anything for us to do together.
There are a million things for us to do together, Maggie.
Are you kidding? What's left?
You're just upset right now. I'll give you some time, but I'm going to call you from Montgomery every day. Did you really think I'd just lay you and leave you? You don't know me very well if you thought that.
One roll in the hay does not a knowing make.
Well, it makes a hell of a good start. He grinned over at her briefly. We're very good together, Maggie. Very good, wouldn't you say?
I couldn't say. I don't remember any of it.
He was silent for another few miles, and then he said, "You will." The Kappa parking lot was quiet when they pulled into it. He stopped the Thunderbird under a tangle of privet hedge. She reached for the door handle. "Maggie?"
"Yes?"
"I guess I love you."
"How about them apples?"
Maggie said. Halfway up the shadowy stairs, her shoes in her hand, she heard the Thunderbird start up, but it did not drive away. She stood for a moment listening, but by the time she reached her room and drew the curtains aside, the car was gone. In one of her high school biology classes, Maggie had built a terrarium from moss, small plants, and an overturned fishbowl. The inverted glass sphere had formed its own environment, fed and nurtured the simple plant and animal life in it by its own alchemy. She lived now in such a vacuum. She was contained within herself. For the first 2 or 3 days after the night in the motel, it was an effort of sheer will to keep the bright, singing bubble tight around her. But she had managed. Sleeping had helped. So had reading. She would not talk to Boots on the telephone. On Monday, after his last class, he had come by the Kappa house. She heard Virginia Cruz calling her from the drawing room. She had gone into the bathroom and locked the door. She had waited until she heard the Jaguar fading out of the parking lot, and then she had come out and resumed her reading. Sister, during those first days, was stricken and solicitous. "I don't think he's mad anymore," she said once. "Gary says he's really down. You won't talk to him, won't see him. He's drinking really badly. Maggie, you're pinned to him. You've got to see him."
"I'm not pinned to him, sister. I don't feel like talking right now, okay?"
"Not pinned?"
I mailed it back to him. "Sister, I don't want to talk to you anymore."
Hoyt had called that Sunday evening and every evening for a week. She would not take the calls. Later that week, a letter came from Aiken. "New York City is fabulous. Everything I thought it would be. Hurry up, Maggie. Get graduated and come on up here. Write me. Call me." There was an address and a telephone number. She did not mention Tuck. She put the address and telephone number into her wallet and put the wallet in her purse. Her parents called that night. Maggie took the call.
"Mama? Daddy?"
Their voices chimed in simultaneously.
"How are you, baby? You're not sick, are you? You sound sort of strange."
"Oh, no, I'm just fine." "Probably out running around every night with that big blonde fella," Comer's voice chuckled comfortably.
"Well, Boots and I are busy, of course."
"Well, listen. The McKelveys have offered us their beach house on Sea Island for 3 weeks in late August and September. We planned to leave the day after your quarter ends, and we thought you might like to ask Boots to come with us."
"I don't know. Boots wants me to go home with him again. We thought we'd drive over after his last exam is finished. His mother wrote me, but she can write you."
Maggie heard her own voice. It was glib and silver and young.
"I was going to call you. You won't mind, will you, if I spend the holidays with the Claibornes?"
How easy this is, she thought dreamily.
"Why, honey, of course not. You go on and have a good time. We'll call you from the beach."
"No, give me the number there. I don't know where we'll be. There'll be parties."
"Of course."
"I'll write you. Have a good time." The next morning, Maggie cut her classes. She did not go the next day either, or the next. She stayed in her room with her door shut and the fan on, reading. "I really don't feel very well," she said to Sister. "I've talked to my instructors, and they've said I could make up my exams next quarter. Mama and Daddy are at the beach, or I'd go home. But it's not serious enough to worry them while they're there."
"All right," Sister said.
For the rest of the summer, they left her alone. The day before the quarter ended, Ben Flournoy called her.
"I want to know why you have not been in your class this week."
He did not say hello.
"Keita and I are very concerned."
"Oh, Dr. Flournoy, well, I've been sick. I have mono. Isn't that the worst? I'm all right, really. It's just that I'm contagious."
"Miss Deloche, I cannot pass you if you don't take your final examination."
"I understand. That's all right."
"Maggie, what is the matter with you?"
"Nothing." He was silent for a moment, and then he said,
"Maggie, would you come and stay with Keita and me?
You should be with someone who can take care of you.
The bell cracked, crazily letting shrieking pain in.
Look how you took care of me, she screamed into the telephone. I don't want to stay with you. I don't want to see you.
I thought that must be it. The column. I wish to God that I had died before I caused you pain.
I'm sorry, she said, crying weakly. I'll see you next quarter. I've got you again for Survey of Moderns. You see, you're not rid of me yet.
No, he said softly. I'll never be that. Goodbye, Maggie.
The next afternoon, M.A. Appleton, the last Kappa in the house except Maggie, locked the house and took the key to the dean. Maggie got into the Plymouth. She drove to the bank and cashed a check for $50. And then she parked in front of the Penn Hotel.
I have to stay here between quarters and make up some work, she told the clerk.
Without the students and their countless rituals, the days were timeless, and she went for two or three without knowing precisely which day of the week it was. After a little over a week, she went downstairs and placed a collect call to her parents at the beach house on Sea Island.
Wonderful time, she told them gaily. I'll call again in a few days.
Back upstairs in the little room that she kept obsessively neat, she lay down on her bed and considered for a moment what she would do next. I'll have to tell them something. Go home or something. That seemed so comfortably remote and unimaginable that she grew sleepy again. That afternoon, sitting later than usual over lunch in the cafe, she saw Tuck. He stood with two other people, an elderly man who Maggie knew taught industrial management, and a young woman in Bermuda shorts and sleeveless blouse who might have been a faculty wife. The woman wore black-rimmed harlequin glasses and very short, cropped dark hair, and had short, heavy legs ending in sneakers, but a slender waist. Tuck had an arm draped around her shoulders and was talking amiably to the elderly professor. It was a comfortable gesture without ardor. I wonder if she's a girlfriend from home. She thought of Aiken for the first time in a long time. I wonder if she's called him or told him about the baby.
He didn't look like a man who's going to be a father.
Aiken's face swam at the glass of the dome like a face through rain at a window, but did not come in. A storm broke that evening just before dinner time. Maggie pulled aside her curtain and looked at the rain, then sat down in the room's one chair. She reached for her pile of books and then realized she had read them all. She pushed a quarter into the slot of the television set. The set flickered eerily into focus. A street in some city downtown area. There were people running, not fast. They were all heading in the same direction, away from the television camera. A young, excited voice stitched out into the room.
Montgomery campus of the University of Alabama, where violence exploded suddenly tonight when it was learned that two Negro students have registered for the fall quarter here. The National Guard has been mobilized and will be on the campus shortly.
The flickering street changed abruptly to the blank white wall of a building, lit in an unearthly glare. The camera lurched crazily, suddenly close in on men holding cameras and hand microphones. One of them was Hoyt. He was looking directly into the camera. The ring of white round the blue eyes shone wildly in the hellish glare of the lights. He looked sightlessly at Maggie. She looked back, looked for the second time that summer into the eyes of a man blank with terror, a man who would do anything. Anything at all to avoid harm.
Hoyt!
Maggie said aloud. She was well out of Randolph before she realized she had left her room. She drove steadily at 80 miles per hour. Voices shouted in her ears, but the singing crystal one was not among them.
Don't leave me.
I won't. Ah, I won't.
You come back and talk to me when you've met a man.
I won't leave you. I guess I love you.
How about them apples?
A man. Met a man. A man. Maggie parked her Plymouth in a darkened filling station, got out, began to run. She ran between the iron gates and onto the campus. The quadrangle was lit into white lunar detail by the mercury vapor spots of the mobile television vans ringing it. Lights spun luridly off drifting wisps of something frosty and white.
That must be tear gas, Maggie thought. I never saw tear gas.
There must have been 2,000 people crowded into the quadrangle. They were a solid wave, a sea, an ocean. The savage noise howled in her ears. No words were audible. The crowd did not seem to be moving much. Maggie broke through it into an open core of space. She saw the guardsmen then, arms linked in a desperate barrier, backs to the wall of a building. There was a glissando of pops from far behind and above her. White dust puffed from the wall, and the line of guardsmen broke and flailed and reassembled fluidly. She saw then that it was the knot of trapped newsmen behind the garbage cans that they protected. Hoyt was there, crouched on one knee, his arms crossed over his face and above his head. Before the khaki line congealed again, she could see that one of the men beside Hoyt lay on his back, very still, and another leaned over him. The crowd at her back pressed forward, and then broke and spilled, bellowing wordless resentment. An officer in khakis, a huge man, raised a bullhorn to his mouth.
"You guys, bring those newsmen out of there! We've got the snipers pinned down! Move!"
Maggie ran straight out of the crowd, past the officer with the bullhorn. She screamed aloud.
"Hoyt! Get up! Hoyt! Get up! Get up!"
The crowd surged after her, and hard, hurting hands caught at her arms and shoulders.
"Get back! Get down, you goddamn little fool! You'll get killed!"
the big officer. Hoyt heard her. He shook off the hands of the guardsmen who were pulling at him. He rose unsteadily to his feet, turned a blinded face toward her. She saw his mouth open, frame her name, bemused, questioning, though she heard no sound. "Maggie?" A thin scattering of pops. He spun and sagged, back and down, infinitely slowly, out of her sight. The officer let go of her and lunged forward, cursing monotonously. The crowd surged backward, carrying Maggie with it. It threw her up on the darkened fringe of the campus against a tree. She leaned against it for a long time, head down like a spent animal. She walked back to her car. Once she passed an empty car with its radio keening into the quieting night. "Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell, down at the end of Lonely Street at Heartbreak Hotel." Maggie reached in through the open window and turned the radio off. She drove out of Montgomery and back down the highway into Randolph and through it and up through the sleeping mill towns of the Chattahoochee Valley into Georgia. She drove steadily and well. When she reached the house on Coleman Street in Lytton, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. For the rest of her life, she remembered none of the drive. She let herself into the house. She went into her bathroom and turned on the light and looked at herself in the mirror over the wash basin. White, still face and dark, mirror water eyes looked back at her. "Still there?" she said experimentally to the crystal voice. It did not answer her. There was nothing around her but an endless, level, lapping calm. She went into her father's study and rummaged paper and ballpoint pen out of the top drawer of the old desk. She sat down and began to write. She wrote for a long time. She folded the letter and put it into an envelope and propped it against a Chinese bowl on the gate-legged table in the hall entryway. Then she went upstairs into her room and dialed the operator and gave a number.
"Aiken? Maggie? What on earth? What's the matter? It's not even light yet." "I'm sorry. Listen, Aiken, I'm coming."
"Coming? Here? To New York? That's fabulous, Maggie, but when? Where are you, anyway?"
"I'm at home now. I'm coming tomorrow, if it's still all right with you."
"Tomorrow? Well, of course, sure. I can't wait.
But, Maggie, what about graduation? What's going on with you, anyway? You didn't answer my letters.
Listen, somebody called you here. I don't know how they knew.
I'll tell you all about it when I get there. I'll leave in a couple of hours, and I figure I'll be there day after tomorrow. I have no idea how to find you, so I'll call you at work before I start into New York. Will you give me your office number?"
Aiken gave her a number, and she wrote it down carefully.
"Maggie, what did your parents say about all this?"
"I'll tell you about it. I have to go now. Listen, I don't have much money."
"You won't need it. We can find you a job. But, Maggie, listen. See you in a couple of days, Aiken."
"Maggie!"
"What?" This guy who called you here tonight, late? It was really funny. I don't know why he thought you would be here. Maggie's heart swelled and stilled. The crystal voice fluted wordlessly in her ears. What guy?
I don't know. He wouldn't say. He just said you'd know. And when I said you weren't here, that you'd be in Lytton now, he said no, you weren't, because he'd called you there, but that he thought you'd be here soon.
What else?
He said to tell you it was just a scratch, and that he'd be seeing you soon.
What was just a scratch, for God's sake? Who on earth?
The crystal voice spiraled up and up, up to a silver crescendo that passed beyond sound into pain, and then out of her ears. Clear, cool, liquid silence washed against Maggie's face. Lucidity flooded the bedroom like rain. Lucidity that trembled on the edge of something radiant that could not be looked at. Yet. Thank you, Aiken, she said.
Oh, and Maggie?
Yes?
He said to tell you he met a man.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. That's 1-800-331-3761. Thank you.